Okay, hi. This is Jeff Reckenbach. We are at 80 Pine Street in New York City with two CWA leaders, Chris Shelton and Dennis Trainer. I also have Debbie Goldman with me. And my chair is squeaking. It's going to drive you crazy, isn't it? Okay. What else do I need to do? And it's February the 28th, 2024. We all good with all your... Okay, so let's start. So the way we like to start this, as Debbie said, is sort of get a little bit about each of your backgrounds.
Oh, and don't touch the mic. That's the other thing. Continue.
She's the only one allowed to touch the mic. A little bit about your backgrounds. So maybe we'll start with Chris, and then we'll move over to Dennis. So tell us about where you were born and a little bit about growing up.
Okay. I was born in 1950. And I was born in Manhattan, New York. And
whereabouts?
Hell's Kitchen.
Okay.
And I moved to the Bronx when I was 10 years old. My father was a postal worker, and my mother was a teacher. And we moved to the Bronx. We lived in the Castle Hill houses, which is a city project. I had a great childhood. I guess it depends where you come from to decide whether I had a great childhood. I mean, I had a great childhood at home. The neighborhood was kind of iffy, but, you know, it was a New York neighborhood that people from New York were just used to. And I went to Catholic grammar school, because my mother and father demanded it. My mother and father were born in Ireland and moved here when they were young. They were very Catholic, which didn't rub off on me too much. But the Catholic grammar school, I went to Catholic high school for a year, got thrown out, and... challenge of authority did not work very well with Irish Christian brothers, but so they threw me out. I went to public high school after that and got thrown out of there, and finished high school at night, actually. Started working first in Wall Street in the 60s decided that capitalism was not my cup of tea, and I went to work for the phone company in 1968. I was in heaven because it was great, and the first thing I did the first day, and that was March 31st, 1968, was join the union, because if I went home that night and told my old man that I hadn't joined a union, he'd have thrown me out of the house. I joined the union, and the union was always great to me. And you know, it had been driven home through my father for my whole life that unions, unions, unions. He was a shop steward for the Postal Workers Union. He was involved in the 1970 postal workers strike. Matter of fact, he got arrested. So I didn't get my challenge of authority out of the clear blue. It came from somewhere else. But, that's kind of rounds out my childhood. I became a shop steward in Local 1101 less than a year after I started with the phone company, which everybody said couldn't happen because you weren't past your probationary period. But I did it anyway and managed to get through. I loved working for the phone company. I loved Local 1101. I still do. I'm still a member of Local 1101. I have been for almost 56 years now. And I will continue to be until the day I croak. But, it's my home, and it'll always be my home, just as New York will be.
So... growing up in New York City, you mentioned your father, postal worker in the union, your mother was a teacher. Was she in the union also?
She actually worked in a Catholic high school.
Yeah, okay.
And she was one of the people who started the Catholic High School Union in the Catholic high schools in New York City, which now is kind of floundering. But at the time, when she started, she was one of the people. She wasn't the only one. But, it was growing pretty much when she was there. But after it's, the Catholic Church has done everything they can to get rid of it. And, they've pretty much succeeded.
As we've seen with the hospitals as well.
They're not fun to deal with either.
You have any siblings?
I have a sister and a brother, both deceased. Hmm.
Okay.
They're both younger than me.
So you dabble in Wall Street. What did you do in Wall Street?
I was a dividend clerk in Wall Street, paying people dividends on stocks. It was pretty boring, actually.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Doing the same thing every day and listening to people who I wanted to either throw out a window or hit with a chair because they were, they were all stockbrokers. Not my crowd, let's say.
Okay, so you go to work at the phone company. What was your first job at the phone company?
I was a technician outside.
Mm-hmm. Installing, repairing?
Repairing.
Okay.
I was a repair tech. That was my whole career in the company was as a repair technician.
And what garage did you work out of? Did they work out of garages here?
Yeah, they did. When I first started, I worked out of the I worked at the 92nd Street Central office, and the garage was on 92nd Street, and we worked in mostly in Harlem, in East Harlem, and. At one point they were calling me the mayor of Harlem because I got along so great with people in Harlem that it was again my home a lot of people didn't like working there because it was somewhat dangerous, but it was only as dangerous as you let it be. Eventually got a two-man area there. When I first started, it wasn't. And we got a two-man area in Harlem, and you went out with somebody else.
Was that a union demand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We had lots of people getting mugged. We didn't have anybody get killed, but we had people hospitalized and stuff because, they got beat up or whatever. On the job, and we felt that we had to have two men. We had a lot of stupid things too, like cops would pose as telephone people and get us in more trouble because they always thought, and this Irish puss, they sure figured I was a cop. But so it was a little dangerous. If you were stupid, it was dangerous. If you weren't stupid, it was okay.
Yeah.
And, all you had to do was kind of get along with the people and you'd be fine.
Yeah.
I had more protection from the people that lived lived in Harlem than I did from the guys that worked with me, actually. Because, they would always warn somebody that they knew, that something bad was going to happen.
Yeah.
So it was a great place to work, I thought, anyway. I eventually became the chief steward in for the whole northern east side of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
At one point in time, I had about 2,000 members under me.
As chief steward?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was great. I mean, I was, again, like the mayor of Harlem. And, I learned to somewhat get along with the management people.
Mm-hmm.
When we needed to get along with them, we got along with them. When we didn't need to get along with them, I'm sure Dennis remembers a lot of this too. At times there was every Friday afternoon we had a walkout. and that went on for years, actually. That's how we got the two-man area. One of the ways we got the two-man area. But it was, it was a, a learning experience, not only in the phone company, but also in the union. I think I learned more back then than I ever learned any place else, and learned how to deal with members and people and just to do my job than I ever did anywhere else. You could take all the college courses, and I taught a couple of them about how to be a union leader, and I think you could take them and stick them and just go out on the job and learn from there.
So how long were you a shop steward before you became chief steward? And was chief steward an elected position?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I was a shop steward for, good question, about 3 or 4 years, I think. Mm-hmm. I got elected as the chief steward during the 71 strike.
Oh.
And I did that until I started working for the National Union, actually.
71 strike was your first strike?
Well, there was a short strike in right after I came on in 68, okay. But it was real short.
Yeah.
71 really was the first real strike that I was involved in.
Yeah. All right, before we go too far, let me turn over to Dennis and get a little bit about that same background. Let's get you up to the point where you get involved with the union.
So. All right. Well, I was born in 1948. He's a baby, you know. I was born in July in 1948 in Manhattan also, in the Inwood section of Manhattan, which was a much better section than where Chris grew up. I went to Catholic grammar schools and Catholic high schools. I went to St. Jude in Inwood, and I went to Powell Memorial Academy in Manhattan for high school.
And you didn't get kicked out?
I didn't get kicked out. No, I was a model student. And I kept my religion too. I was also a Catholic, and was taught by the nuns and the Irish Christian Brothers of Power. I also went to school in grammar school and high school with the then Lew Alcindor, who became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar later on, you know. And I tell the story to Bob Mast all the time. He gets a kick out of it, because in grammar school, my one claim is I was the catcher. Lew Alcindor was the pitcher. And Lou used to throw like about 90 miles an hour as a 13-year-old, you know, but he couldn't throw straight. So every batter that got up there was definitely afraid to stand in the batter's box, you know. So he either walked the person or he struck the person out, you know. But that was my claim to fame. I never played basketball with them on the teams. We did play in CYO a few times with them. I got married in 1969. I joined the phone company in 1969. Before joining the phone company, I had gone to announcer's training studio to become a DJ. And my wife and I were going to travel the United States, from DJ to DJ until I became back to WABC in New York. You know, I became the star, you know. I must got the job before I did. But in 1969, I went to work for the phone company because my father said, why are you waiting for this big break becoming a DJ? He says, it'd be nice to have a job, you know. So I went to work for the phone company for only a week or two or a month or 2 months, and 55 years later, I'm still hanging around, you know. So I got involved with the union. I went to Splice's Helper School for a couple of weeks, and when I came out of Splice's Helper School, I went into the garage, which was a fantastic garage. And the first thing they did is, you know, they hand you a card to join the union. I was happy to do so. My father was a bartender, but he was a proud member of the union. He used to show us how he had how to pay his dues, and he had a little book, and I still keep that book at home to remind me that my father was a good union man, even as a bartender. And I worked for the phone company, and I got involved in 1971 during the strike in 71. I was frustrated as hell that the strike was going on as long as it was going on, and I remember going to one of my stewards, Jim McEwen, and asking Jim, that we have to do more. We just can't stand around. And Jim said, well, if you want to do more, you got to get involved, you know. And he made me become a steward during the strike. so that I could get involved and get more people involved. And but it didn't help. 7 months later, we finally settled the strike for a dollar more.
So were you also in 1101?
I was also in 1101, okay. in the Bronx, though. You know, much better section of 1101 than the Manhattan area. And we were proud. We competed a lot. Who was stronger and who did things better. But I came from the Bronx River Garage, which we are proud. 1101 was a strong local, but this guy Jim McEwen reminded me that every contract, whether you were in Albany or Buffalo, was the same contract, but you made it as strong as the people around you. And he said, if you can make the company honor the contract, then you have a strong contract no matter what's in it. And to this day, I use that, you know, I believe in that. I think that, you know, we can have the same contract, whether it be in New York or California. And if the local is weak, it's going to be a bad contract. If the local is strong, it's going to be a good contract.
Did your mother work?
My mother didn't work to I got in high school. I think she went to work for Hertz, but not in that, she didn't hold a union job.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Can I jump in with two questions? Both Catholics. Were you also from Irish background?
Yes.
Dennis.
Yes.
Okay.
All my grandparents were born in Ireland. My father was born in Ireland.
Was the local, the technicians, largely Catholics and folks who came from Irish background?
I wouldn't say that, no. They were mostly white. You know, I mean, you
back
didn't,
then,
back
yeah.
then you didn't see too many people of color.
And when did you start to see women? Technicians.
We saw the first woman technician, I think, in 19... right before the 1989 strike, I think we had the first splicer outside. We had technicians on the frame that were women in the 70s, late 70s. Jane Harmon, I remember, was the first woman that came to work for the phone company and was a CWA member. She came to work in the 70s. But it wasn't right before the strike in 89 that we had our first woman that worked outside in the field.
Would you say it was a very male culture then?
Yes.
Local 1101. I'm not sure.
Well, it wasn't just 1101.
That,
it was New York Telephone Company, right? But I mean, 1101 was, you know, representing them, so it was. But we also had, we didn't have the operators at that time in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. To your question, you know, like women outside, I'd say. In the 80s, early 80s sometime, but maybe a little later, I'm not sure. But your question about white male Irish technicians, when I started working for the company, there was a cadre of, we used to call them the old Irish guys, who, you know, they all had brogues and they all worked in telephone plants like hospitals and stuff like that. And they would do almost anything to protect their job, even from us. You know, they would hide junction boxes and ceilings and wire things backwards so that nobody could ever do their job. It was pretty weird, but you know, once you got to know them and they got to know you,
then they let out the secrets.
Right, it all changed and. You became one of the old Irish guys.
Right.
You know, and I guess I had a leg up because my mother and father were born there. So, you know, they didn't view me as one of the enemy, as the enemy, actually. But and Dennis probably did, too, because, you know, they would look at if you were Irish, it was different than if you were some other nationality. But it wasn't any kind of prejudice. It's just...
I saw it more as an overtime protection. If they taught you anything, then you would have to share in their overtime. So they wanted to make sure that they were the only ones that could do the job. So they didn't share any information with you until they really got to know you.
When did blacks start getting hired in these jobs?
I would say in the 90s, you know, more so. I mean, we didn't have that many blacks.
We did. I'd say... in the 80s again. You know, the garage I worked in was pretty pretty much half and half. And, you know, it was just, and like, nobody really noticed that it was half and half. It wasn't, you know, I think unlike other workplaces, the phone company, you didn't, there was no prejudices, really. You didn't, there was no, you didn't see, like, this guy hates black people or whatever. It just wasn't like that.
Why?
I don't know. It just, you know, I guess most of the people that worked for the phone company were brought up in diverse neighborhoods. And, like, where Dennis lived and where I lived was really diverse neighborhoods. And you were just used to people of different ethnicities. And you know, it was like I grew up in a place where, you know, nobody ever noticed that the guy you were playing baseball against was black or Puerto Rican or Chinese or whatever. It just, that's just the way it was.
It was the Vietnam era too. A lot of people had come back from war, okay, and you know, middle, you know, they just, you know, everybody just fit in. You know, just you know, I don't think we, to Chris's point, I don't think no one really looked at color. I came from a area growing up, okay. I grew up in the projects where it was blacks, whites, you know, I mean, very, some Puerto Ricans, but we didn't really, it didn't really influence us at all, you know. I think the telephone company was more prone to hiring white people first, okay, prior to the 70s and 80s. I think after the Vietnam area, late 70s, early 80s, I think it started, you started seeing more, but we didn't, you know, we didn't pay attention to how many they were hiring or anything like that. It was never something that we even talked about, you know.
So you didn't even notice it, really, because, you know, like Dennis says, we both were brought up in the projects. Yeah. And, you know, now it's it was like Lincoln grew up in a log cabin. I mean, you know, we grew up in the projects. Well, that's just the way it was then. And you didn't notice. You really didn't know. I mean, I couldn't tell you. If you gave me a list of names from my old garage, I don't know if I could tell you which one was black and which one was white. I really couldn't. Because nobody ever, like, paid any attention to it.
And so that era, AT&T enters into a consent decree with the EEOC. Is that 1974?
73
is 73?
When it was implemented.
Okay, 73. And so is that when you begin to see this again, just for some perspective, we didn't control the hiring as a union.
Right.
The employer did, unlike the trades where they had a hiring hall, and they were the ones that were actually doing, you know, the hiring, so to speak. Is that when you begin to see this change, this shift? And just to make the distinction, so you were in an I&R installation and repair garage, and you were splicing together.
Jeff was appointing to Chris for the I&R and Dennis for the splicing.
So the company at that particular time, and the reason I think there was probably more people, you know, white and there was because they made it. They, at that time, people coming out of high school were getting jobs in police department, fire department, sanitation department, phone company, Con Edison, you know, and they, it was like, can you find me some people to come here? So they used to come and used to get credits for, like, you know, bring me five people in. So, I mean, you brought your friends, okay? That's who you got, your friends, your cousins, or whatever, okay? So that's how hiring was done in those days, you know?
Yeah, after the consent decree, I'd say it, and I don't even know that it changed a lot, but operators or inside people, you know, became more black than they were before. But outside, I don't know if it happened that early or it, yeah, the problem is that you didn't really recognize that, hey, that guy I'm working with is black. So to tell you when it happened, I don't know that I could do that. But I think it was probably late 70s, early 80s. I don't know. But, you know, and before that, I don't remember the garage being all white guys. But Maybe it was. I don't know.
But I even know now, when, like, we're trying to get new hires in, the company is very aware that we just can't go to you and say, hey, can you get us some people, okay? Because that wouldn't make the ratios that they want, you know? So they said, we can't do it the way we did it years and years ago, you know? And that's a big change even in the last 5 or 10 years, you know?
Yeah, no, I remember when I got hired, you could have gotten a job at the steel mill, the auto plant.
Right.
I mean, there were...
There were jobs.
Yeah, anywhere. And my mother telling me, the guy across the street works at the phone company. That's a good job. That's where you want to go, the phone company. So let's talk a little bit about your 1101 time. We'll start with Chris. And you know, so you've gone for chief steward. Talk about some of the experiences in those roles within the local before you actually take an assignment with the national union.
As a chief steward in 1101, and this – I don't think happens in a lot of locals, but it did happen in 1101, and I'm sure Dennis will back me up. You know, you got involved as a chief steward in lots of things that you normally wouldn't in another local, because you usually had so many people and so much power that it was, you know, you were the person and you got involved. And like, I did arbitrations. I didn't do them, but I was at lots of arbitrations. I called my own walkouts and got in trouble for it many times. Actually got fired 6 times.
Really?
Yeah. You know, 1101 was a different place than a lot of other locals because, you know, first of all, they would finance if you wanted to go to school to learn how to do arbitrations or learn how to do whatever, they would finance it. A lot of locals, A, couldn't afford it, or B, were somewhat worried about their chief stewards running against them, so they wouldn't do that kind of stuff. In 1101, though, if you were a chief steward in 1101, in the time that we were there, I don't know about now, but you were completely and absolutely loyal to the officers of the local. Mm-hmm. Not because they told you had to be, it's just the way it was. And I can't think of a case where chief stewards actually ran against the officers of the local in those days. Mm-hmm. Because not because anybody said, you better not run. It was because they didn't want to. And they let you do things, organizing, all kinds of stuff that other locals, people would, you know. Being a chief steward in 1101 was like being a vice president
or
of
president.
Some other local. Well, better than, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with 2,000 people.
Know, right, I was kind of the president for those 2,000 people.
Yeah.
How big was the local?
When I came in, 16,000.
And which boroughs?
Manhattan, the Bronx, and Brooklyn.
And all technicians?
No, inside people, outside people.
But all technicians, inside.
But you didn't have operators there, did you?
No. We'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, you really functioned in a world where you were running your own local when you were a chief steward in 1101.
Did you work for the union full time then for 1101, or did you still stay on the job part of the time?
I was one of the first chief stewards that ever got on full time union business. Actually, I was paid by the company and off on union business 40 hours a week every week for, I'd say, almost 20 years. And, you know, the company recognized it too. I mean, you know, it wasn't like they wanted something done. They had to come to the chief steward because otherwise it wasn't getting done. So it was a whole real different world than even other CWA locals. You know, at least I did. I'm guessing so did Dennis. When I started working for the national and went into other locals, I couldn't believe some of the shit that went on in those locals because of people not being able to do what I considered their job. because they were so different than what I was used to.
So you got fired six times. Tell us about one of the more momentous occasions where you were fired.
I don't remember when it was, but this management guy was sitting in the foreman's office. It was a big garage, so the foreman's office was gigantic, and they all had desks around the office. And this guy was having an argument with one of my stewards. And he was screaming at him. And my guy was doing just as well. Mm-hmm. And the foreman at one point went over the desk. So I went over the desk and grabbed him by the throat. And I got fired for it. That's one. Usually it would, that was the only one I think when I hadn't called a walkout that pissed somebody off. You know, but the guy deserved it.
What was the longest you stayed fired for?
A couple of months.
Really? Talk about that. What was that experience like?
You know, the local picked up my salary, okay. And I did my job, mm-hmm. just like I wasn't. I was still the chief steward in whatever garage. They wouldn't let me in the garage, but.
And how did you get your job back?
Usually through negotiation, once through arbitration, but mm-hmm. Usually, you know, somebody saw the light through the hole in their head and rehired me.
So Dennis?
Wait, I want to hear about the walkouts.
Okay, yeah.
You know, they would. The company would do something stupid. I would try to get it fixed, and they wouldn't fix it. And the only recourse was a walkout. And I don't remember why, but the local was at a convention someplace once, and I called a walkout in my district, and the rest of the local walked out. And all the officers were in, well, I don't know where the hell they were, but they weren't happy about that, but hey, whatever. They knew it was me, so it was par for the course.
Who were the officers at that time?
Well, when I first, Howie Banco was the president mm-hmm. of Local 1101. You probably never even heard his name, but after that, a guy named Ricky Carnival during the 71 strike, who I wanted to kill, and
so did everybody.
Yeah, well, not everybody, but a lot of people. And he actually left me in jail during the 71 strike. I called the local, got him, and he said, "Who's this, Chris?" Yeah, click. My one phone call. he was a real piece of shit, though, and mobbed up too. His old man owned a private carting company. So we didn't have a great relationship, let's say. After Ricky, Ed Dempsey got elected, my mentor and my favorite, and I could spend the rest of the day talking about Eddie. His son now works for Dennis, but.
Dennis.
Jeff.
Tell us about your early years in involvement with CWA.
Well, I in 1971, like I mentioned earlier, I became a steward during a 71 strike, and we were in Bronx Construction. We felt it was the best part of CWA. We always told Chris and the boys in Manhattan that we were the strongest, and I got involved as I was very involved in the union and became a chief steward in 1976. And the day I was elected chief steward, I took my keys, walked into the second line of his office, and said, "I won't need this truck anymore," you know, and never worked again. I worked, I was on 40 hours union to pay, I mean, the company to pay, joint conference time. And like Chris, we had an office in the Bronx, and that's where I reported to. And you know, I met the, you know, I had two garages of construction people, and when the company didn't do the right thing, and basically a lot of things were over overtime, or we would have job actions, and we would do things, and some of the job actions we had caused a lot of grief for me, because I ended up getting suspended too, or fired. And well, one of the job actions we had was we decided that every truck needed to have their ladders checked, and so we had two garages, and we had over 300 trucks lined up going to one garage, because that's where they tested all the ladders, and everybody took their ladders off. They had the trucks all the way down one street, all the way down this Tremont Avenue, and there were 200 trucks with guys walking with their ladders walking down there. The next day we had another something with the trucks windshield to checking this, checking that. But the next day the company had managers from all over the place. They brought them from Manhattan, they brought them from Queens, and they had two managers by every truck, making sure that we checked our vehicle, and out the door we went. So the job action didn't last as long as we thought it did. But we were very strong, but it taught me a lot about mobilizing. It taught me that, you know, if you want something done, you get your members involved, and you get the members involved, you're stronger, you can get the company to listen to you. And even with all those actions, the company would come back and say, what was the problem? Why did they do that? You know, and you'd have that conversation. And that's why I think we're able to maintain that 40 hours, is because they knew we kept labor peace. And, you know, and if we didn't, you know, if something went wrong, we had walkouts like Chris was mentioned earlier. We looked forward to Friday afternoons in the early 70s, you know, and because it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there was somebody was, and we didn't have cell phones or anything. It was word of mouth, you know. Everybody knew the trucks were heading back to the garage, and by 2 o'clock, everybody was heading home for a long weekend, you know. So
heading home or heading to the bars?
Heading to the bars, you know. Yeah, you're right. But it was a lot of fun. We had a very strong union, and people stuck together, and we fought together, and I think that's what made it, you know, strong. The 71 strike made us a strong unit. You know, we knew that we stuck together. It made us a strong union, 1101 and all CWA. And, you know, that carried on right to 1989, you know.
And where do you two guys first come together?
Actually, you know, we knew each other from the locals being chief stewards together, but we really didn't, you know, work together that much on different things. We really got together when we started working on the National Union.
Yeah, just, you know, there was always a rivalry between the Bronx and Manhattan, always.
Because we were better, you know.
But, and I think Dennis will attest to this, too. I was probably the only chief steward of Manhattan that really got along with the Bronx, because right. I lived in the Bronx, and that's not the only reason, but you know, I was into a lot of the things that the Bronx guys were into, and yeah. You know, we got along better, and you know, that was another thing that I noticed about other locals when I first started working for the National. In 1101, like Dennis said, you always got the members involved. It was always the members, the members, the members. And these other locals, it was like the officers, the officers, the officers. And they would like forget about the members. And they couldn't figure out why they couldn't win anything. They couldn't win anything because they didn't have enough people doing what they needed done. And in 1101, it just never would work that way. And it didn't work that way.
Yeah, we were in charge, chief stewards. That was your unit. You were like the president of that particular unit. Okay, so you felt good about your group, and you wanted to make sure that they were strong and they were always together, and that you had meetings all the time. You had, you had union meetings once a month at least. You know, if something was happening, it was more often than that. You know, it was nothing. You know, we don't have that camaraderie today, that where you have that many meetings and meet people. And, you know, it's a shame that we just fell out of that, but we were strong. We were extremely strong, and I think it's because we cared about each other. We cared about people's families. If something was, if there was a fire in somebody's house, the people in the garage took care of those people, made sure that they were cared for, and you know, or with anything that was going wrong with, you know, we were family, you know, and 1101 was a family.
I'll give you a for instance. We had a guy, I won't tell you his name, but he died, and he had young kids. Kids were in high school. And so we decided, he worked in a big hospital in Manhattan. I worked in that hospital at that time too. We decided that he wasn't going to die. And so we kept him on the job. And everybody knew, the foreman knew, the second liner knew, everybody knew. And he worked overtime every weekend, every night. For 3 years, we kept him alive, working on a job, because his kids were young and, you know, his family needed the money. And, you know, you could get away with that kind of shit back then. Now, forget it. But the hardest thing we had to do was when we finally wanted him
dead
to die, we had to get a doctor in the hospital drunk to sign a death certificate. But we did it, and you know. But those were the days when you could do that kind of right. stuff. You can't obviously do it anymore. But.
Does some of this have to do with New York culture and New York being a union town?
I think so. Yeah.
I guess, yeah. But you know, like this guy was one of the original old Irish guys, and he died, and he had young kids, so we decided.
Well, I think we took care of our own. Yeah. We had.
Yeah. It could have been. Yeah. A black guy or right. whatever. It could have been anybody. If it, you know, you work with the guy and something happened that he needed you, you just did it.
We had one individual that died on the way home from a garage. He actually was transferred out to Brooklyn and was where it was when they were downsizing, and he was sent over as a garageman over to another garage, and he was coming back at night and got killed in a car accident. And he wasn't married, but he lived with his mother, and at that time he had a death benefit, but it was only for your dependent was that it was dependent on you. So if you had a spouse, you got the 1 year's payment, and they weren't going to give it to this finished person because he lived with his mother, but his mother had a job and she wasn't dependent on salary. So we had the people from benefits come over to the mother's house, okay, and myself, and you may remember this name, Joe McAleer. He was vice president of the Bronx, who I worked for, and at that time we worked very closely together. But Joe and I went over to meet the benefits people with the mother. Now, she was a real Italian individual, the mother, okay? Joe McAleer, his face was Irish, his Irish. And he came in as the cousin of this person and was trying to convince the people from benefits, okay? Well, we convinced the people, they finally gave it to him, but as we were walking out the door, they said, Joe, we know who you are, you know? But we got the benefit for the mother, you know?
It was a different time in the phone industry as well.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, it was a monopoly. It was,
right,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, yeah. It was clearly different structure altogether, so, so, okay, Chris, you're chief steward, and you've got 2,000 members that you're responsible for. At some point, the national union comes, I presume, to Dempsey and says, hey, have you got somebody, or do they come directly to you? What happens there?
I had gotten involved in, heavily involved in organizing. As did Dennis, and I guess that's how we kind of hit it off, because we were both involved in organizing. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten involved, like I say, in organizing, and the National Union, the operators in New York Tel were a separate union. To call it a union is kind of stretching the word to a place it shouldn't be stretched to. But and so we decided, and Eddie Dempsey was involved also, we decided that we were going to try to organize the operators and get them into CWA. They were in one of the old independent unions, the TIU. What the hell was that? Telecom International. You know, I don't remember. And so I got involved in that and was off the job for like probably a year doing that. And we were successful. We brought 10,000 operators into CWA. They formed actually where my wife came from, Local 1110. And they became a regular CWA local. We got rid of the, I won't use the adjective that I normally would use, but the officers that they had in TIU. And eventually we got rid of all of TIU. And Dennis will tell you another story from Connecticut that, you know, more or less the same kind of story. And that's how I got my, I guess, intro. You know, I knew lots. I knew Morty when he was the vice president here and stuff yeah. like that. But how I got my intro into the National Union and why I think the National Union saw me as valuable, I don't know. But
let's talk a little bit more about TIU and organizing. What I mean, I presume they're an independent union; they're not affiliated.
Right.
And so, how did you go about trying to bring them into CWA?
And what year was this? About.
1983.
Okay. Right before divestiture, but it had been
yep.
announced already.
Yep. You know, we did it the old-fashioned way. We did it with the members because the officers of the local didn't want anything. They fought us tooth and nail because they knew that we would oust them the moment we got our hooks in there. And for a good reason, not because they were, you know, the officers of an independent union. It was because they were useless, and actually worse than useless. They were dangerous. And, you know, the operators have been getting screwed for years because of these people, and we wanted to end that. And we saw a value to having the operators help us, and they did. So, you know, we got down into going into operators' offices and getting people to work as organizers for CWA. My wife was one of them. Went to federal court to oust the officers of the local at one point and testify before a federal judge. If you asked her about that, she'd tell you how wonderful that was. You know, we did the old-fashioned way. We got down in the street and we went from office to office to office to office, and we just did, you know, we organized the way you organize. We told them about CWA, and then at one point, AFSCME got into it. We were calling it the AFSCAM because, you know, they were yabbering about how nobody knew how to deal with operators like AFSCME. Give me a break. we had an election and we won. And, you know, it wasn't easy, but it was certainly gratifying. And it was certainly even more gratifying for the operators. You asked anybody who was an operator back then, they would tell you that was like the day they went to heaven when they came into CWA. Even though the officers, some of them, that we put into office at the time, later went to jail for stealing. You know, you can't get them all, but...
Did Gay Semmel come out of that?
Yes. Gay Semmel was an operator in during the 71 strike and tried to organize, was part of the organization at that time, trying to organize the operators in 71, which failed. But, yeah, that's where Gay came from. She was an operator in 71.
Who wanted the picket line?
Did you meet your wife during this campaign?
Yep, I did.
What was her maiden name?
Same name she's got now, Petrella, Joyce Petrella. Mm-hmm.
So it's a mixed marriage.
Actually, she's Hungarian.
Okay. So you mentioned AFSCME trying to get involved. It just tickled the memory. And I don't know the timeline about this, but the Teamster raids of CWA.
The Teamster raids were before
back in
that.
Was this the 60s? Okay.
No, it was, I think it was the early 70s. I don't remember, to tell you the truth. But maybe it was the late 60s, I'm not sure, but the Teamster Red was actually Jimmy Hoffa and me became very good friends, right? His son, not
yeah, him. Yeah, right.
And after I got elected president of CWA, and he always used to kid around because during the Teamster Raid, I was an organizer for the Teamsters. So was Eddie Dempsey, by the way. And actually, they tried to throw us out of CWA on point for dual unionism. But Hoffa used to always kid around that. Like if he couldn't go to some place, he'd send me because I was one of his stewards. He was a pretty funny guy. But the Teamster Raid was kind of weird because the company really fought off the Teamsters more than CWA did. The company sent letters out to people and did all kinds of illegal stuff. They sent pictures of Teamsters beating people up on picket lines. They sent them to guys' wives instead of the guys that were going to vote because they figured the wives wouldn't like any of this stuff. And it worked. The Teamsters lost, and they lost interest and went away. And, but it was an interesting period, let's say.
Did you meet Jake LaMotta?
No.
Okay. anyway, you to get back to getting asked then to join the CWA District 1 staff, who's the district vice president at that point?
Who was it?
Was it Jan? Or
Jan? Was it still Morty? It was Pierce. Yeah. It was Jan Pierce.
Yeah. And what assignment did you get when you first came on?
I was an organizer.
Okay. Working on any particular project or?
Actually, right when I came on, I did a printing sector organizing. It was the first one that was done in New York in over 50 years. Uh-huh. And it was successful. And it was, to say weird wasn't... doesn't even come close to covering it. The printers were a weird group of people, and still are.
Yeah, what's left.
Yeah, what's left.
Yeah, yeah. Dennis, when did you come on board, CWA staff?
I came on board in 1999 on staff, okay? But prior to that, prior to getting involved with the National Union, I was made an assistant to the president in 1101, actually working for Joe McAleer, the vice president. But that's where I got the chance and the opportunity to start negotiating small contracts. We had these independent companies, telecom companies that we had, and I had the opportunity to start negotiating for those small contracts, which was very helpful. And I also represented Empire City Subway, which was a subsidiary of the New York Telephone Company. They did all the digging of the streets, and I for contract negotiations in 1986, I did a complete video. This is before, you know, you had all the software to do all your video and stuff like that. I did film and I did camera work and I did my own video and audio and put together this presentation. So that we could give it to the company in bargaining, and it was done well, and I think that the company said, well, we're going to give the raises because of the video, but we got breakouts for everybody in Empire City, and I was very proud of that particular moment. After that, I in 1998, it was a big organizing drive going on in Connecticut for the Connecticut Union of Telephone Workers, and I was asked to go up there because my brother Jim was originally supposed to go, but he was going on a cruise. So McAleer said, you go. And therein lies the difference, because if it was Jim, Jim would be sitting here and you'd be interviewing Jim instead of Dennis. So I went up, and it was the greatest time of my life. Unfortunately, I left the house and I was gone for 4 months. I spent in Connecticut getting to know
We had close to 7,000 members in the Connecticut Union of Telephone Workers at the time. They came to us. They felt it was time because SBC was looking at that time to buy SNET, and they wanted to. The local felt they'd be stronger if they were part of a larger organization. But they also were talking to IBEW to see if they could get IBEW. So you had IBEW trying to get in, you had the people that wanted CWA, and then you had the old guard that wanted to keep the CW. So CWA sent up organizers from all over the country to help. And I spent 4 months there, and I got to know, I would say, every single member in that union, okay, personally, where I knew where they were. I was, when the count came down in July 9th, 1998, I practically knew exactly what that count was going to be, and we won that election, you know. And then we went into bargaining, and the local president then got a TA without ever coming to me or any of the others. And I was still up there, and the members were furious at us. I mean, we got, like I said, I got to know them all, and they were so mad that, how could you do this? So I said, we're not going to accept it. And I remember calling up Morty that night and Larry Mancino and saying that the members won't let us take this contract. I told Morty that I spoke to everybody. I hadn't spoken to anybody, you know, and they wanted ripped up. So Morty basically told us, have your meetings, but we're going to tell the company we don't have a TA. And Chris knows that, you know, that Larry Mancino, you know, called up the CEO and woke him up in the middle of the night and told him, you don't have a TA. But we had meetings every night that the week after that. We had 4 meetings around the state. People that we had given out shirts and hats and, you know, all kinds of paraphernalia to everybody. Well, this one meeting that we had in New London, Connecticut, we had about 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 people there. They all jammed into this gym, and they all brought their shirts, their hats, and they threw it in a pile. I was so dejected. I came back to our office at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I see Steve Early, you know, lying on the floor on his hands and knees, putting papers all over, you know, getting ready for the next day, saying, we just have to, you know, stick with it and get back to it. And that's what we did. We went back out there. We told them we weren't accepting it. We had another meeting the following night. We were in the Holiday Inn in the Hamden, Connecticut, and NBC News was outside while the meeting was going on. And Morty had told me to call Larry and Morty at one time at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, and I called, and I was watching the TV, and as I'm watching the TV, Keating, the president of the local, was ripping up the agreement on TV, you know, and I said, I guess that's your answer, you know, and you know, the next day we went to the company and we decided that, you know, we were going to fight to get the contract that they wanted. And we mobilized the members like never before. We did everything that CWA taught us in the past, how to get that crew mobilized. And we went into negotiations, and we had a 28-day strike. I remember the Saturday before we went out. Now, I wasn't a staff rep. I wasn't a local officer, but I was at the bargaining table. And the internet was just, you know, in its infancy, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Al Gore just invented it. And and I was on the computer, you know, basically telling the press that we were going to have a news conference at 11:30 that night, okay, to decide whether we're going on strike. And the company, as we were bargaining then, you know, I'm doing this all while we're talking. They came in, when they're running in with a piece of paper, and they say, what is this? You're calling a strike. I said, yeah, we're calling a strike. If we don't get a contract, 11:30, we're going out. 12 o'clock, we're going out, you know. Well, at 12 o'clock, there were 1,000 people outside the hotel where we were bargaining, you know. And we walked out. They were furious. And, you know, I mean, I don't even know if Larry or anybody else knew we were going on strike. But we went out. We were out for 28 days. And the thing that helped us win, it was all about timing. SBC wanted to buy SNET. They wanted this thing over. And they called whoever they had to call and ended it. But it was so great. Just one interesting story about the mobilization. We had these garden parties, we called them, and we had people that showed up for the garden party not knowing what we were going to do. And maybe we'd have 500 people there, and we had maybe 6 or 7 buses. And we got into the bus, and this one particular trip, we went to the CEO of SNET's house in Connecticut. Now, we had no idea if he was going to be home or anything. We all got off the buses. We marched in front of his house, and I'm knocking there. We're filming everything. Oh, NBC was there. They went everywhere. And we're on the bus, they didn't even know where we were going. We wouldn't tell them where we were going. We knocked on the door, you know, come out, come out, come out. We knew he wasn't there, you know. So we started walking away. You know, everybody's walking down the street. As we're walking down the street, who's walking the other way with his wife holding hands? Was Emilio, the CEO. So everybody gathered around. Now, we had little kids with us, and he's patting kids on, his wife was patting kids on the head. And the member saying, don't you touch my kid. Well, we blast this guy about not settling the contract, you know. And the following week, we had a contract, you know. So it was just a great time of figuring out, you know, how you mobilize, how do you, you know, pick the right time. It was just timing was right. SBC wanted, you know, us to end it. SNET wanted to get out the door, and they said end this thing. But we got the contract we wanted with the raises that we needed for our members, and, you know, it was fantastic, you know. So
just to add to this, this poor bastard that was the CEO, when Dennis called me and Larry were in Verizon. I don't even know if it was Verizon. I guess it was Verizon bargaining at the time. So we were in some hotel someplace.
Larry Mancino.
Yes. And Dennis talked to Larry and told him, you know, that this nitwit president had agreed to a contract that was terrible, and the members were up in arms and blah 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 blah. And Larry, could you like get in touch with the CEO and tell him? Larry says, sure, don't worry about it. So we had to go back into the bargaining, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, Larry, we finally get the number for the CEO's home phone number, right? There was no cell phones at the time. And Larry calls this guy 2 o'clock in the morning, and his wife answers, right? And she says, who is this? And he says, it's Larry Mancino. She knows who Larry Mancino is, like, you know. She has no idea who the hell he is. Put your husband on. So this guy gets on the phone, and Larry tells him, hey, listen, you guys signed a contract with this asshole that's running 1298. We're not agreeing to it. Forget it. Stick it. And the guy is like, who's this? And then they did all of this stuff the next day, you know, and then started all these garden parties and the strike and everything. And it was pretty funny, actually.
Yeah. That's a pretty good Mancino imitation. For an Irish guy.
Yeah, well, that's another thing about Larry. Larry could speak Italian, right?
Yeah.
And we would go into an Italian restaurant. You know, I grew up in New York, so Larry used to say that I could order in an Italian restaurant better than he could. Even though he could speak Italian.
So talk a little bit about some of the leaders that you worked with over the years and what those relationships were like. Chris, why don't you go first?
I guess I got to start with Dempsey. You know, and I don't know if you knew him, Debbie. But
I didn't. And let's just be. First name is
Eddie.
Ed.
He was a little guy, you know, short in stature, but that's the only place where he was short. I'll just tell you a story about Eddie would always play on the fact, A, that he was a New Yorker, he was from Brooklyn, and that he wasn't well educated. He played that to the hilt. And we were in federal court, and I don't remember why we were there, but I think the bell ringers at the time had sued the local over some shit. Who knows? I don't know. But excuse me. And so we're in federal court, and Dempsey's on the stand, and it was the judge that became the judge in the Trump case that became the the guy that turned down the one in Florida's, I don't remember his name, but anyway, he was the judge. As soon as I heard his name, I said, oh shit, that's the guy from federal court. So Dempsey's on the stand, and the lawyers, they're cross-examining him, and Dempsey's doing this. Well, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure. And so the judge says to him, Mr. Dempsey, you know, could you please answer the question? And, you know, we don't have time for all this stuff you're doing. And he says, well, Your Honor, you know, all these lawyers, I never went to high school even. So, you know, I don't know what these lawyers want. And I'm not even sure what the questions they're asking me mean. And the judge says to him, Mr. Dempsey, you've proven beyond any doubt at all that you're much smarter than what you make out to be, and that if you never graduated from high school, it would have been a waste of time for you to go to high school. That's just kind of how Eddie was. And he was, I mean, in bargaining, there was nobody like Eddie Dempsey. He would... you'd go to a meeting out in the hallway with him and the company, and he did everything in the hallway. Nothing was done at the table. And he would always have something in his pocket, a note, saying, hey, Jack, you know, you got to do this stuff. Come on, here. And they would argue with him. And there was nobody like him at a bargaining table. He was fantastic. Knew when to push, when to back up. And when to just press, when to get the members involved, when to have some kind of demonstration. He was a master at it. And, you know, his son actually learned a lot from him, I think, because his son is pretty much the same way. Dennis sends his son into places where we're going to have some time getting a contract there, and John gets the contract wherever it is. So, you know, I guess it was a family trait, or his son learned from his old man, but he was just, he was the best, and I learned just about everything I know from him and Larry Mancino and Morty. Hopefully I learned enough that I got past, but...
Obviously you did. So Dennis, what about your relationship with different CWA leaders over the years?
Well, like
who
Chris,
are your mentors?
Well, McAleer was one of them, okay,
and McAleer was Dempsey's vice
president,
executive vice president,
He was vice president of Bronx, and according to McAleer, he was the king of CWA. He felt he when he had to organize the operators, he felt that he did it, and you know, like he was the king kingmaker, and he operated as the president of the Bronx, and Dempsey basically let him do whatever he needed to do to get it. But he was a rock model, but also Ed Dempsey, just the way he operated. One of the things I always remember about Ed always, you know, no matter he thought the members. Voice was so important, and one of the things he taught me is that he visited garages all the time, you know, just morning visits, and it instilled in me when I was the chief steward to, well, if he can do it, I can do it, you know. So I used to make sure that I got my stewards, had my meetings with the stewards, I had meetings with the members, you know, with morning meetings, different groups. Ed would meet a small group at a time just to get their opinion about what I think. And it was never a time that you could ask him to come up for something that Ed didn't show up for us. Whether it was I had a problem, he would come to the garage, you know, even if we had a small, what we thought was a huge problem. But I'm sure Dempsey's probably going, oh my God, I got to go up there, you know. But he was there. It was no problem was ever small for Ed. And I that always stuck with me that, you know, he was there for everybody. And I always felt that I had to do the same type of thing, that, you know, if you're going to do the job, do it well, make sure that you represent all the members, not just who you want to represent. So he was definitely the role model. And, of course, Chris, when I got to the National Union, Chris and I became like, we did everything together. It was Chris and Dennis doing the contracts and whatever, but I think I learned so much of him on
how he did the contracts and how he negotiated. And, you know, I think we were a great team working together. But
something you said earlier, and I just harken back for a minute, but you talked about putting together a video presentation for one of your bargains. And the thing I remember about you from back then was you always had your camera with you.
Right.
So have you done anything in terms of the historical record that you've created with that?
No.
You really should think about it.
I have it all. I will.
I mean, some of that stuff has got to be just, you know, a treasure trove of information.
Oh, it sure is. I got it all documented and stuff. It's just a matter of doing it. You have to spend a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I get that.
Yeah. But I did. I would have my camera no matter where I was. Yeah. So I'm with a camera, okay? You can always be there. I remember going to Morty's retirement party, you know? And, you know, like the President of the United States there or Kennedy was there and everybody. You could walk around. This Secret Service, like, when you have a camera, it seems like you can go anywhere, you know? And, you know, but...
I mean, that would be a really a great thing to hand over to the labor archives.
Right.
I mean,
no,
just,
you're right.
You know, I hate to see that somehow get
pushed away.
Aside and lost. No.
Yeah, it's got to be like...
Yeah.
First of all, voluminous is not even close because
he was a pain. If I would go to a District 1 meeting, you were down there with your camera, you're videoing and still photography, the whole nine yards. You know, and just the depth of that has got to be you know, really something to put our hands on. I'm sorry, I didn't want to get sidetracked, but you know, I thought of that at the time and we went somewhere else.
And when you look at those pictures, some of those pictures, it reminds you of things that, you know, like me and him are sitting here trying to remember shit that happened 50 years ago. And but if you looked at a picture, like there's a picture roaming around in CWA someplace, for instance, that there's Morty and a couple other people walking in front of a picket line. And I saw the picture a couple of years ago, and it reminded me of what was going on when that picture was taken. It was the 1971 Western Union strike.
Oh.
And they were picketing, not they, I was there too, we were picketing the Western Union building. And Morty was up front with the flag and blah, 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 blah. And the Western Union building at that time was a whole city block.
Yeah.
So the entrance was like, say, here. And as we got past the entrance, me and Larry were in the back of the line. And... just so happens a bomb went off in the lobby right as we got past the entranceway. It wasn't a big bomb. Nobody got hurt or anything. It was
a cherry bomb.
It was bigger than a cherry bomb. But, and so Morty comes running back. When I saw this picture, it all came back to me. Morty comes running back. And this was a pretty long line because, you know, there were thousands of people that worked in this Western Union office. And he says, "What did you two sons of bitches do?" And me and Larry are laughing. But we didn't do anything. We didn't know about it. And we told Morty that. We didn't know. Yeah, as soon as you got past the entrance, a bomb goes off. And you two didn't know anything about it, right?
50 years later, he's still denying.
We didn't. It was some crazy Western Union guy. Larry knew the guy, but that's it. But that's, you know, you see a picture, and it reminds you of stuff that you haven't thought about in 30 years.
Yeah. So just your pictures are both photographs and videos?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, when we get offline, I have to ask you for a picture, specific picture.
Okay. Yeah. A specific picture.
You can bet he'll have it.
Okay, so now you're on the CWA staff. You're starting off doing organizing work. Talk a little bit about your progression.
Yeah, just I forgot before. While I was doing the print sector thing, I also started doing 9X Mobile.
Okay.
And another one. Pierce gave me these two things because he wanted rid of me. I figured nobody's going to win in a printing contract and nobody's doing 9X Mobile. It ain't happening. So... me and him loved each other. Debbie, you look surprised. So, 9X Mobile, we organized during the 89 strike. And, you know, everybody said, it can't be, it's not going to happen. We won by like three votes, but we won. And it was at the time, I think it was the first mobile company that had been organized. I'm not sure if it was. The District 6 may have organized Southwestern Bell before, but I'm not sure. Everybody was very surprised, especially Jan Pierce. He didn't know what to do. But I got to bargain the first contract at 9X Mobile, which turned out to be a great contract. Matter of fact, Dempsey got pissed off at me because the 9X Mobile contract was better than the contract for the technicians. And I said, hey, you taught me how to do this. And then Pierce at one point, they deserted, and Pierce let them desert because he wanted them out. We got them back. But it was pretty interesting to do a mobile company. The different type of member, different type of employee than anything that I had been used to anyplace. Very devoted to the company because the company had hammered it into their heads that was the best company on earth and that they would always take care of them. And now Dennis does a great job of keeping them in the fold, which is not easy. But that's so. I forget what question you asked me.
No. I mean, that's just figuring out what exactly you were doing in your career as a CWA staff. At some point, Larry Mancino becomes the vice president of District 1, and you become an administrative assistant, an assistant?
I was still a rep when Larry got elected in 1996. I should say that when Marty went to Washington, Dempsey and 1101 were all ready to support Mancino for vice president. And I was assigned to help Mancino get elected. And then it was decided that Pierce was going to be the vice president, and Eddie changed his mind, which I had a big argument with him over because I hated Jan Pierce. And so did Eddie, by the way, but he just thought that Pierce would have an easier way to win. I don't know where I was going with this, but, it was an interesting time, and I then got into representing locals as a rep, and 1996 Larry gets elected vice president. Again, it was he won in a walk, but we had to do some work, and so I get called in during the campaign, and Lisa Reardon, who was I don't know if I should use her name, but
you did.
She was Pierce's assistant. She's got stacks of cases on her desk. And at the time, I had local 1105, which was the reps local in New York. And their grievance procedure was like nuts. I would go there and do 500 grievances a week. Anyway, she's got all these files, and I sit down in the office, she says, and Pierce knew I was supporting Mancino. At the time, it was me and Eddie Baxter were the two that Larry called first. And so she says to me, you see all these cases? I said, yeah. These are all 1105 cases. I said, yeah. She said, they're all timed out, and you timed them out. I said, look, let me explain something to you. First of all, I've never timed out a case in my life and never will. And you can take these cases and stick them because I didn't time them out. And what are you going to do? You're going to fire me because I'm supporting Mancino? If that's what you're going to do, fire away. She then backed off because she figured out that she couldn't prove, because it was all bullshit. I mean, I had never timed out a case in my life. I said, let's get 1105 on the phone right now. Get the president, I think it was Kathy Siner at the time. And I said, ask Kathy if I've ever timed out a case. No, that's all right. Okay. I'll talk to you next week about this. Never talk to me again. But that was Pierce trying to take a shot. But, you know, I guess they figure I was going to throw myself on their mercy and then support Pierce, which was not going to happen. But, you know, that's the kind of shit that happened. And Larry became the vice president, which was one of the happiest days of my life, because Pierce was gone. And, you know, I was a rep and got a lot of locals, and me and Larry got along great. I mean, I don't know that you could get along better than we did. And I eventually became the his assistant. And,
well, area director first.
Excuse me?
Area
director. Oh, yeah, I became the area director of downstate New York and Connecticut. And then became Larry's assistant over lots of people's objections. And, you know, then when Larry left, I became the vice president of District 1.
So what were your bargaining experiences like during that period of time? I mean, is this, who's president for the 89 contract?
Morty.
Morty. Oh, I'm sorry, vice president. I meant vice president in District 1.
Pierce.
Okay.
But I got this another good story. Mm-hmm. Pierce was the vice president and supposedly in charge of the bargaining. Pierce didn't have a clue as to how to bargain the price of lunch for two. And there was a Malcolm Lovell, where is he? His picture's on me, right there. Mm-hmm. Was the mediator, the federal mediator, who was a very officious, it's not like mediators now. I mean, yeah. This guy was, you know, like you'd think he was a federal judge or something. But anyway, Pierce was way, way beyond his abilities. And at the, what I call the end of the bargaining anyway, Malcolm Lovell was in a room, Pierce was in a room, and Larry shows up with me.
Larry Mancino.
Yeah. And Pierce was shaking because he didn't know what to do. He had no idea. You know, we were we had been on strike for a long time, and he was just, like I said, he was beyond his abilities. And he was shaking, and Lovell says to Larry, you think maybe you could step in here and try to do something? And Larry says, sure, as long as he says so. He's the boss. And Pierce would have agreed to let the devil step up at that point. And he says, yeah, we gotta get this over with. Something's got to be done. And he's shaking. I mean, physically shaking. And so Larry calls a meeting of all the staff that's doing tables. You know, there's different staff at each table. I think there was 11 tables at the time. And he says, okay, you do this, you do that, you do this, you do that. And I'm going to see the company. He goes to see the company and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, 2 days later, I guess, we had a contract finally. And it was because of Larry. I mean, Larry was the best, and, you know, he kind of freed up the staff to actually bargain because Pierce didn't want anybody doing anything except him, and he didn't know how to do it. So Larry saved the day. We'd still be on strike if Pierce was here. And it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. It was all about health benefits, Chris, and we saved our health benefits. And
Yeah, it was. That was the, you know, there was a lot of bullshit on the tables, but health benefits was the whole McGilla. And it, quite honestly, it's because I think, anyway, and I kind of know, I don't think, that Morty had agreed with the old CEO before the 89 strike in 88 that we were going to change our health benefits and we were going to pay something. Morty and him had a meeting at a racetrack, and I happen to know that Morty told him that.
Told him that, or told him that we'll put this off until 89. And the this is why I'm asking, because I heard this story. George told it. George wasn't there. You were there.
No,
so
I wasn't there. But
George told the story that there may have been a misunderstanding.
Yeah, well, that was Morty's lament. I don't think there was any misunderstanding.
Morty wanted to get the contract in 86, and that's how he got it, okay?
Right.
By I give him a little wink that, okay, we'll
right.
never do this again to you, you know? I think
so
that's
how did you hold the strike? Talk a little bit more about the 89 strike. Mm-hmm. It was a long strike. How did you hold it all together?
We worked a year before, at least in 1101. And I had come on staff like right before that, but we worked the members, and the members were down. They weren't not going back to work until we got our health benefits paid for by them. It just wasn't happening because we had made it a cause celeb that line will not be crossed, and they agreed with us. And I'm sure Dennis will tell you the same thing. It just wasn't going to happen.
We did a very good job of with the defense fund and the members relief fund. We make sure that people's at that time we were paying people's mortgages. Mm-hmm. We were paying people that were really in you know, like electric bills are down, and we had a system down there. If you were in trouble, we got you paid, okay? But we were mobilized, and we had the Flying Circus. We had a group of the Flying Circus where people wore jackets, we were proud. We went out on special missions at nighttime. I'll tell you a funny story. It's past the years, so I'm sure I can't get in trouble for it.
Yeah, you always got to watch the statute of limitations.
There's a few of them listed up in some of these newspaper articles that are behind you right now.
So we had the Flying Angels went out. They were a bunch of scabs that came in from around the country. They were staying in Jersey, and we found out the hotel that they were staying at. So we went out there at 2 o'clock in the morning with maybe 20 cars, 25 cars, okay? And we had these little knives that we had that weren't the ice picks, really, you know, to little give flat tires to the scabs' cars, you know? But we would get everybody flat tires. So, you know, we parked our cars and went around the hotel and gave everybody flat tires. And then we were getting back into our cars to go back. Well, a lot of our own cars had flats. That's how smart we were at 2 o'clock in the morning. But it's a good story to tell. But, I mean, we were mobilized, and our members were proud to be part of these different groups that we had. And we just stuck together, and everybody knew that we weren't going back. And, like, the 71 strike, the 89 strike made us stronger as a unit and as a union. You couldn't beat us. And you know, like the 89 strike, and like we were all said, like the 89 strike got us a contract in 91, 94, you know, and same thing as in 2016. We went on strike in 2016. We had great contracts, the next two contracts. The company was coming to us. They didn't want to be bothered again, and that's how it was in 89. You know, I think we showed them that we could be strong. We were a unit that, you know, you're not going to fool, you know, you're not going to break us, you know, no matter how long it was. So
talk a little more about the Flying Squadrons. What'd they do?
I can't get into all the stuff that.
I don't mean that stuff.
But it was a group that.
My understanding is it wasn't just picketing outside the central offices.
We followed
the scabs.
We followed the scabs during the day. Okay, that was not only the Flying Circus, but that was we didn't do just regular picketing. Okay, we felt that that was not. Never going to get us just walking around in front of a building. There's nobody there all day, right? They took the trucks out and they left. And meanwhile, we're sitting there. What we ended up doing is just drinking beer all day long, right? So we felt the best way to do it was go out to the jobs they were on. So if they're working on a pole or a manhole, we had scabs around that manhole. We had scabs around the poles.
Yeah, picket lines.
And picket lines. Yeah. So they were really, just hammering them all day long. And they would call the cops and everything like that, but you know, Gay Semmel and, our attorneys made sure that we knew exactly what we could do and not do. And everybody followed those instructions. And, you know, some people got in trouble because they carried a little bit too far. But, you know, we got them out of jail pretty quickly. You know, we posted bond and whatever. But we were very well organized. We, you know, everybody knew that they had an assignment to do during the day. It wasn't just going to that building and walking. We kept picket lines going there, but
We made sure that people, every job that we could possibly do, we were following them outside, you know, wearing them down. And then when they left the garage at night, we followed them back to the hotel to let them know that we were outside the hotel they were staying. If you were going to dinner, okay, you might be sitting right next to us because we're going to follow you to dinner, you know. So, and I learned that in 1971 strike, my wife went into a restaurant with a newborn baby, okay, and chased some managers out. She says, you know, I've been watching you for hours sitting here drinking, you know, and they were so annoyed with her that they just walked out the door. So we use that kind of logic, you know. If you know they're going in there, follow them in there and just embarrass them in front of the customers in the store, you know. So it was things like that that we did, and we kept our members involved in it, and they were excited about it instead of just sitting around doing regular picketing, you know.
But did you use the mobilization structure? Or did you use a steward structure or a separate picket?
It was a combination of both. In some areas, we didn't have strong stewards set up. Like I think my particular place was always strong, but some in the Bronx, some areas weren't strong. Then we had a mobilization structure. Okay, and the reason for that structure was that people that weren't stewards, didn't want to represent people all the time, got excited about being involved with the mobilization, and we used that structure. And Bob Massa was the key of setting that stuff up in 1989. It was the first time we really used a mobilization strategy, you know, like it was the one that was developed by Bob.
That's actually how Jerry Hogan got killed, the 1989 strike.
Tell that story.
Because he went to a place where they were weak, and he went there to pump them up, and then the scab ran him over, and, killed him.
It was Westchester, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And by now in 89, you're striking 9X. It's not just New York.
It's
you're 9X. Dealing with New England as well.
Right. So the interesting part about that is that the coalition that we had with IBEW there and Miles Calgary and the relationship that we built with them, okay, we're making sure that we kept them close to us, that they didn't go back in, okay, that they stayed out. And that was very big component of that, to make sure that, you know, they were on the same page as we were, because they weren't getting it. They didn't have the defense fund or the members relief fund.
We didn't have the members relief fund either at the time.
Well, we didn't have the members relief fund, but I tell you, the defense fund that we had, I think we spent every nickel.
We did.
And Morty had to go borrow.
That's how the members relief fund got created.
Right. Yeah.
Because
right.
We spent every.
That's right.
And then Zendetsu lent us $300 million, the Japanese Telecommunications Union, because we were out of money. We had no more money.
And what was the slogan of the 89 strike?
A slogan in 81 strike? I don't know. In 74, it was seven more in 74. I don't know. Do we have one? You probably know, right? Did Bob tell you that we had a slogan?
Healthcare for all, not health cuts at 9X. That's what he told me.
Oh, yeah. You know, Bob was interested in those slogans. Out in the field,
we were not. Well,
we just wanted to win.
That's what
we're talking
about. Right. Yeah. And we did win.
Yeah.
And the company was pretty pissed off when we won, I think. But hey, they'll go.
But that the whole mobilization strategy, Bob should get all the credit in the world for developing that, because he developed the books. We had the training. You know, I mean, we went into that strike knowing that everybody had a role to play. You know, and it was all because of the strategy that Bob built and the workshops that we had prior to that, us going out on strike. It wasn't just, you know, and that's one lesson I've always learned. We don't go on strike when the company wants to go on strike. We go on strike when we want to go on strike. You know, we pick the date. It doesn't have to be expiration date. And go, like in 2016, we picked our time. We made sure that it was the right time for us, not the right time for the company. And we made sure that in the 89 strike that everybody had a role to play in that strike. And we made sure that everybody knew that they were playing a role, you know, and that they had to be involved, you know. And I think we made sure that everybody knew that, you know, that they were involved in that strike.
Yeah, you know, me and Dennis are sitting here telling you all about the 89 strike and the 71 strike, like, kind of like, you know, we did this and we did that. When we say we, there's a lot of people that work here that, or used to work here maybe, that actually accomplished all this stuff. It wasn't me and Dennis. It was, you know, scads of people. Bob Master is one of them. There's lots of people that were really, really involved up to here, and that's how we won, and getting the members involved up to here is how we won, and you know, it's pretty easy for me and Dennis to sit here and tell you what happened, but you got to understand that it's, you know, it's hundreds of people, thousands of people that actually got this over the top and did what they had to do to make sure that that we won this stuff. You know, it was pretty amazing. And if you ask the company at the end of 89, or in the midst of 89, they'll tell you they weren't giving up, just like we weren't giving up. Mm-hmm. But we lasted longer than they did, so.
So let's jump ahead. You're vice president now. What year did you get elected vice president?
2005.
What?
2005?
Yeah.
2005. Okay. You're in the midst of divestitures taking place, and now they're reconnecting. And what's it like in District 1 as your vice president?
District 1 is a whole different place than the rest of the union, I think. Yeah. And there's reasons for that. And the reasons for that, because we made it that way. And you know, what I wanted to do was carry on what Larry had started, which was to unify and solidify District 1. And, you know, for instance, in union elections, let's say, national elections, District 1, before Larry, had been all over the map. And Larry started to get it solidified so that everybody would vote the same way. And everybody would do everything together, that, you know, it wasn't somebody going off on their own doing, you know, like we had stuff like at one point in time, 1109 went off on their own and started organizing contractors. But they were contractors that were doing our work, and it pissed off everybody else. And now everybody wanted to kill 1109 because they got the guys that are doing our work, and they unionized them. Larry was a great unifier and taught me that that's the way it should work. And I carried that on and made District 1 even more solidified, more unified. And I think you saw it in everything we did, elections, conventions. District 1 wants it. Ain't nobody stopping us. We're getting it because everyone, every single local is going to vote the right way.
And when you're talking about unify, District 1 now has huge unit in New Jersey, public workers.
Has what?
A huge units in New Jersey, public workers.
Right.
You've got New York City, a public worker unit. You've got the nurses up in Buffalo. Got the printers. Who else? I mean, Unify now isn't just unifying.
Nope,
New
absolutely
York
not.
And so talk about that.
And you know, quite honestly, Jersey, for instance, Larry started to unify Jersey, and I think I carried it on to where we got it unified. And it was a pretty hard place to get it unified because the locals all thought that they were going to run the show, and this one hated that one, and the other one hated this one, and it was like nutso. So it wasn't an easy job to do it, but I think we did it, and I think that, you know, I started bargaining contracts in Jersey and for the state workers, and Larry did one before me, I think, and actually we did it together, and you know, it worked out pretty well, and we kind of taught them that they got to stick together to get stuff done, and they did, even though they still to this day, I think, this one hates this one and that one hates that one. But when Dennis comes to them and says, okay, we need to get this at the convention, or we need to elect this person, they do it. What?
Don't put your pick on the table.
Oh, I'm sorry. I told you I wasn't going to be good at that. I break podiums when I make speeches, so. And I think that's part of the reason that we've been as successful as we have in all these arenas, because the nurses don't feel like they're the nurses in Buffalo. They feel like they're the nurses in District 1. The public workers, they're not the public workers in New Jersey. They're the public workers in District 1. The public workers in New York, same thing. Even the printers, to an extent, even though there's not very many left, felt like they'd been taken in, and I don't mean taken in the bad sense, but taken into an organization that cared about them, and that all those other parts of that organization cared just as much about them as they did themselves. And, you know, Larry taught us that, and I hopefully carried it on, and Dennis, I know, is carrying it on, and that's why District 1 is pretty strong to this day. And you know, if you ask anybody in the National Union, what happens if District 1 votes that way, or does District 1 vote together, they're all going to give you the same answer. Absolutely. Some of them don't like it very much, but hey, life is tough. You know, we decided a long time ago that it had to be that way because we were wasting the biggest resource in the union.
Want to take a break for a few minutes?
Sure.
End part one. Begin part two.
Okay, we're back with Chris Shelton and Dennis Trainer, along with Debbie Goldman and Hannah Goldman at the controls. And so we just entered the Shelton era of vice presidency at District 1. Can you talk about some of the challenges that you faced with the telecom industry during your years as vice president? What were some of the issues that were in the forefront?
Well, you know, always in the telecom industry, for as long as I can remember anyway, there was technological change. And in lots of places, for lots of reasons, it resulted in downsizing. And, you know, not only I, but lots of other folks decided that, you know, we were going to try to, even though we had dealt with technological change quite well in this district anyway, in the Verizon contract, because, you know, we never said no, because you can't say no. It's like saying no to an oncoming train. So, you know, we decided that we should figure out a way to use it to our advantage. And for the most part, we did. And when I took the job of vice president, I decided that we should do so even more because the technological change was coming faster and faster and faster. Part of the reason why the wireless industry became prevalent. And, you know, there were lots of technological changes even within the wireline industry. So we decided to try to bargain with the company on ways that would become our work instead of, A, some contractor's work or, you know, some way that it could be done by robotics or automatically or whatever. And we were pretty successful, and we negotiated mostly with a guy who's now dead named Jack Navarro, that any kind of technological change, we would get the work. And we actually did, and they kept their word, and we got most of the work, all the fiber work. There was never an argument here. We got it. Mm-hmm. And in other places, for instance, in AT&T, they had to fight like hell to get it. I don't know why they didn't, before it ever started, go after it like we did. And we did, and we made out very well. And I'm sure Dennis will tell you that, you know, we just never had an argument about it. It was ours, and that's the way it was going to be. And the company went along with us. And Jack Navarro, to his credit, figured out that we would do the work better than anybody else. And he was right. We do. I don't know that we do it cheaper than anybody else, but, you know, when you're doing a whole brand new technology like that, cheap ain't always the way you want to go. Good is the way you want to go. Like I always said, when Obama was in office and they were spending all that money on fiber and stuff, that they made a big mistake by not giving it to the union people, because if they had, it would have got done under the Obama administration instead of waiting till now when Biden's in office. And now I hope it's going to get all done by all people, and it's going to work, unlike in the Obama years. So I don't know if that answers your questions or you want to add something. But
no, I think you covered it.
I think Dennis could probably tell you a lot more about the wireless industry than I could, because he was one of the people who actually ended up organizing them. You know, I had the Dynex Mobile, but that's a small cog in the wheel, and Dennis went after the whole wheel and did very well in going after the wheel.
Yeah, let's go to that in a minute. Was there a breakthrough moment though with Navarro? I mean, was it at a bargaining table? Was it what was the catalyst that got him to sort of see that and agree to that?
I don't really remember if it was at bargaining. I think it probably was at one of the bargaining. You know, I did so many Verizon bargainings as the dentist that they all kind of run together. And I don't know which one it actually was, but I think it was at a bargaining. And I don't remember who the CEO was, but that's another thing, that we always had a fairly good relationship with whoever the CEO was.
I think it was Ivan at the time.
It was Ivan, okay. Yeah.
And Ivan Seidenberg.
Yes.
Yeah. And Ivan had a lot of faith in Navarro, so he would listen to Navarro. Matter of fact, when we were buying a contract in Washington with, what was that guy's name? That shithead that...
Lowell McAdam?
Well, McAdam was the CEO at the time, but who's the guy to work for him that I really couldn't stand, you know?
Yeah, senior moment here again, too.
Well, anyway, there was some guy who worked for Lowell McAdam who was, actually, it was before McAdam, was that other guy that came from wireless. But anyway, he was supposedly doing the bargain, this guy, and we knew, because we had been told, that Ivan sent Navarro down secretly to actually do the bargaining. So the Hyatt Hotel in Washington, I met Navarro in every room in that hotel at 2 o'clock in the morning for the whole 3 or 4 months that we were there. We were in every room in that hotel, and we actually got the contract done, and I got it done with Navarro, not this other guy. What was that guy's name? We went to the mediator with him, and
I wasn't at that bargaining.
Is this 2000 when you were on
strike? Oh, you were at this bargaining, because I remember being at a mediator with him, and when he told me that we were bargaining over retiree benefits.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And this guy tells me, old people are too expensive. And I went over the table, and he grabbed me. And I said, excuse me again, but I said, you tell your mother and father that, you fucking piece of shit. And he was like, oh, the mediator thought I was going to kill him. And the mediator wanted to go, oh, let's have a break. And we left the room. And this guy was a Trumper, too, for a little while, until Trump crashed his daughter's wedding. He owned he belonged to the same country club as Trump did in Jersey. And his daughter got married, and Trump crashed the wedding before he was the president, I think. And this guy then hated Trump, and me and McAdam used to torture him over this. Because before that, you would have thought he was Trump's brother. I forgot. So Navarro.
Yeah.
You know, he had a lot of pull in that company that people didn't really understand. You know, he was the vice president of labor relations, but
Ivan Seidenberg trusted him immensely. You know?
Yeah. He was like, if Ivan needed to know something about labor, that was his guy. Yeah. And we worked great with him. I mean, I had a relationship of probably 30 years with Navarro from when he was a first liner. And, he agreed that we were going to get all the work, and we did.
In contrast to Verizon Wireless, tell that story.
Excuse me?
Verizon Wireless.
Oh, the, you
could
mean,
never break into there.
Mobile. You mean 9X Mobile?
No, no. Well, in Verizon Wireless.
And
too.
Then
why would they break into Verizon Wireless?
Well, Dennis did most of the Verizon Wireless contracts. I did the 9X Mobile contract. But then, like I said, Pierce let them desert and did nothing about it. And then, you know, Dennis did a great job with
AT&T Mobility.
AT&T Mobility and Singular and you name it, he did it. And, you know, it's another place where it was real hard to break into. And that was one place where Seidenberg would let us just walk in. It was partially our mistake because before wireless actually became wireless, we could have had all that by negotiating over it with what was then called the radio gang that did that kind of work before there was actually a wireless company.
The old car phones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we never did. We were just stupid. But, you know, but you want to know about wireless, he's the guy.
Yeah, so Dennis, talk to us a little bit about the wireless experience.
Okay, so I came on staff after helping organizing the Canadian Union Telephone Workers into CWA. That was in 98. I stayed with them, and Larry asked me to come on staff in 1999. And SNET at that time, well, they now became SBC, they had in their contract, they had a division of wireless workers in their contract. And at SBC at that time owned a division of Cell One. So we got our first lead up in Buffalo, and we got another lead in Albany, and in Rochester, and Syracuse, all upstate New York. And we got those units, we got organized each separate units. Then we got Boston. And we started negotiating then in January of 2000. And at that time, they wanted us to negotiate separate contracts in those locations. Then we had I think SBC reached out to Morty and wanted to have early negotiations for the wireline contracts. So we had a meeting out in San Diego where districts 1, 4, 9, and 6, I think, all met, and they represented SNET, Ameritex, Southwestern Bell, and Pac Bell. And at that meeting, we decided that we would also try to get, because at that time, District 2 was trying to work on a wireless contract in Baltimore, and I think Terry Pluto was trying to work on something in District 4, and we committed that we wouldn't take agreements unless we had wireless agreements too. And we all went back to the districts, we started negotiating the contracts towards the end of the year for the wireline side, and we still weren't getting anywhere with the wireless. They still were making us negotiate these separate contracts. So we brought all of our bargaining teams down to Connecticut from Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, and Buffalo. We brought them to the same hotel where we were negotiating with SNET, or SBC at the time. And they wouldn't acknowledge that they were even there. We said, we can do that. Then we're just going to bounce from one room to the other room, you know. But we were successful in getting them to recognize the contract we had. But we couldn't get to the contract by, they wanted it by 12/31 by the end of 2000. They wanted to deal with all the wireline contracts. We couldn't get there in wireless. So everybody agreed that we were going to walk away from the table. And we did. And they were making threats that you're not going to get a wireline contract. Well, I don't think Larry Cohen got a call like 2 days later, you know, saying, can you get everyone back at the tables? We're ready to talk. And they got everyone back to the tables. They brought all of our tables. We got District 2 then to come up to Connecticut, and they agreed to take everything that we had already TA'd, which was very important so we could put everything together.
We then got Terry Pluta from District 4, and Jeff, you know, you probably remember mm-hmm. this, that it was very important that we get District 4 to say, okay, bargaining committee, this is what we already negotiated. This is the TAs we already got. Will you accept the same thing, and then we can just put them all together? Terry got her bargaining committee to agree on that. Then we gave it to Larry, and we got the, which was extremely important to us, we got the wage tables. And one of the reasons why we were able to get the wage tables is that we had the contract we had in SBC already had wage tables in theirs. We wanted them all to be the same, so they gave us the wage tables also. We were then insisting that in certain cities like Boston and New York City, we had to have a city allowance, you know, some kind of more money for those cities. Well, they were completely against that. So what Larry was able to do was then get an extra step or two extra steps, you know, so we got more money for everybody, you know, and that was the last piece of it to bring them all in, you know. So we then once we got the deal, it was, I think, a couple days after we got the deal, they no longer sell one, it was singular. And from there, we also had a neutrality agreement with everyone, so everyone that came in across the country, all they had to do was, you know, get the group to sign in, and they got the contract. We pour them all into the orange contract, you know. So why I think this is so important is that it's the way we negotiated that contract is a model, I think, for the way we should do others. We used that same model when we had Verizon Information Services, which was the yellow pages of Verizon. We had 19 contracts in District 1, District 2, and District 13. And Verizon wanted us to negotiate 19 separate contracts. And we set all those tables up in different locations around District 2, 13, and District 1. We had everybody at the table. And myself, Jim Short, and Barbara Schiller, Jim Short from District 13, Barbara from District 2, and myself from District 1, came to one location in South Jersey. We met there. And the company didn't have their chief negotiators there. They just thought it was going to be one table. But after the first day, so we presented proposals at that table, and we had the identical proposals. We presented all 19 tables at the same time. The company realized what we were doing. The next day we were bargaining, the chief negotiators from 2 and 13 and 1 were all at the table that Jim and I and Barbara were at. And we negotiated at those tables. They kept the 19 going for a while, but after a while, they realized that this doesn't make any sense at all, and we have one contract. And we see it now with a lot of contracts we have, that if we can join forces and work together, okay, it's easier to try to, you know, get a lot more strength. And I think that worked great for AT&T Mobility, and I think it still does. I think we just got District 6 just got a contract the other day, and there was some arguments that from one of the vice presidents was saying, well, we still have mandatory overtime there. I said, there's mandatory overtime in every single telecom contract that we have. We're not getting rid of it. But it goes back to that theory that I have, is that we have to stop that. We can't let the company to abuse mandatory overtime like anything. A contract is just as good as the local makes it. And the vice presidents all agreed on the call the other day. There's no way you're getting rid of mandatory overtime. But I think every contract always improves on the last one. District 6 just improved on the orange contract that we just had. District 3 will be doing a contract next there to improve on that one. And, you know, I just think that we need to do that. We learn by doing. We learn by what was successful in the past. And with Verizon Wireless, with Verizon Wireless, we have been unsuccessful because we never got a neutrality agreement, you know, and the workers in those locations, they're most of the time they're not, especially in Verizon, they're not there as long as long-term employees. They're there, they start young, they're young employees, they're not interested in the union. They're taking the job, and they may leave. They may leave the T-Mobile or another company the next day, and it's extremely hard to organize them. And when you do get a new unit, okay, it's almost impossible to get a contract. Now, our relationship with Verizon has gotten better
since the 2016 strike that we had. And just recently, we only have a couple small units in New York and Brooklyn, by the way.
These are retail, correct?
In retail. And we started organizing a couple out in Portland, Oregon. And as soon as we got them, I went to the company, the labor relations people on the Y Line side here, and said, can we get the same contract that we have in Brooklyn? And I've gotten that. And not only did I get it, but I thought they would give me an expiration date that was, you know, later out. They gave me the same expiration date that I have in Brooklyn. So we got a couple more units like that with the same expiration date that we have in Brooklyn, which is the same expiration date that we have on the Y Line side. So that when we come back in the table in 2026, okay, hopefully we get more units that we can bring it all together, you know. But it's a constant battle with Verizon Wireless, and it's because of that neutrality agreement. If we had a better agreement with Verizon, where you know, we have access to members and really get a chance to talk to them, I think we'd have a better chance. But it's you know, we don't have that access.
And they're still, the company is still fighting the union.
They fight the union on that. Yeah, they don't give us access. If we get them, once we get them, but until the time we get them, okay, they're fighting us, and we're trying to get them to ease up on the fighting, you know. But that's a challenge right now.
Do they force elections or?
Yeah, you know, they force elections.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about 2016 bargaining. What was that experience like?
So 2016, I just became vice president of the district. Chris was the president. And, you know, the important thing about that was, again, you know, making sure that District 213 and District 1 were united, which we were. We had a great...
And you still got the IBEW.
And we still
there.
have Miles Calvary. Oh, he always says he's going to hitch his caboose onto our train because...
That's in New England.
That's New England.
What about New Jersey?
And New Jersey, we have Bob Spear in New Jersey who's with us too. And it's he's... And they really listen to District 1 really leads the whole group, you know. And you know, Ed Mooney was great to work with. He was you know, and I'll tell you one story. When we got the contract, we didn't have the Verizon Wireless contract done yet. We had a holdout, and this is after 2016, right, where we just went through a strike. And Ed made sure that we got the contract in wireless before we ever settled. But going back to the contract negotiations, you know, we were fighting over the normal things that we normally fight about, mostly benefits. But one of the main things that we were fighting about was the type of stress that everybody was being put at work site. The kind of management on your back constantly, and the technicians, you know, they had all these new plans and these new work rules, and people said they just couldn't live with these rules anymore. And that was one of the biggest fights. We wanted to make sure that they got rid of some of these silly plans that were putting our members through, you know, changes that they, you know, they couldn't operate on how they, you know, the amount of work they had to get done during the day and stuff like that. There was just no sense to, you know, everybody was treated the same, well, you know, on the jobs. And that was one of the main reasons why we went on strike. But when we went on strike, once again, Bob Master, you know, with his mobilization strategy, and another key component of this was that we got all the unions in the city. Everybody seemed to be on our side. And like when we went on strike, and this was told to us by Lowell McAdam when we were down in the Secretary of Labor's office, Perez, he said he thought he was fighting the whole entire labor organization when the CWA went out on strike. Everywhere we went, it seemed like every union was there with us, and which was so important. And you know, that was a lot of Bob's strategy in making sure that they were there with us. That, you know, they were, you know, whether any kind of rally they were at, that you had the other unions there with us, and like we were fighting for everybody. And you know, so you know, we were on strike. We weren't going anywhere. Chris was able to work out, you know, getting Secretary of Labor. Perez to bring all the parties together. He brought all the parties together and he kept us there. And the last night that we were there, you know, everything on the board, and he wanted this CEO Lowell McAdams wanted to leave. He said, I have 12 o'clock, my pilot can't fly anymore after 12. He said, well, you call your pilot and tell him he's not going anywhere. You know, you're staying here.
We had cooked this up before. Yeah.
And McAdams, you know, just went back to Saturday. He says, we're getting a deal today. And Tom Perez said that he had his daughter's graduation or something that he had to leave, and we had to be out of there by 8 o'clock in the morning. So we had to. So around four, we were just about done, right? But I have this thing about being, Chris, no, I have everything. I don't make the decisions. I'm from my bargaining committee. I have to go back to my bargaining committee and say, this is all right with you, you know? And they said, you know, I mean, I got you this far. This is where you wanted me to take you, okay? But I'm not saying it's okay unless you're there, you know? So I told this to Perez. He said, you kidding me? You know, like, we all want to go home and you're going to. So he says, when can you get there? I says, well, they're back at the hotel. I said, they're all sleeping, but I said, you know, I knew they'd probably be up somewhere, you know. So I said, give me a couple hours. I'll be back by 6 o'clock. And he gave me a couple hours. I went met the bargaining committee. They were fine with everything they were going to do. But, you know, that's the commitment I always make to them is that, you know, I'm not going to make a deal unless you all want it, you know. So Mooney, I think, did the same with his bargaining committee. We got Chris together and went back with with Perez. And we got the deal. But Perez kept us there. I mean, Chris getting the Secretary of Labor involved in this, okay, we'd still be out on strike if he didn't get involved. But Lowell McAdams, you know, he realized when he was meeting with us and he started telling us the stories that when he was going around to the different buildings and seeing the picket lines and how he was cursed at and told, you know, everything bad about it. He just didn't realize that his employees felt this way about the company. And to his credit, he said, we got to change that. And, you know, he says, we got to come out of this contract. Okay.
And he meant we.
Yeah. And
and he meant we.
Yeah. Yeah. And he worked with us to make sure that we do. And it was very hard because our locals didn't want to deal with this at all. They said, screw them. You know what I mean? And even, you know, my assistant now, Billy Gallagher, I mean, he didn't want to trust them at all. And I said, listen, I said, they want to work with us, okay? And if he's saying this is going to happen, okay, the only way it's going to happen is if filters down to the first level guy, you know, is doing what the boss up there wants them to do, and now our members feel it, you know? So we brought in a mediator that worked with us. Remember when we brought somebody in? And
this is after the
contract. After the contract. And to work on our relationship and how we were going to work together. And to this day, I mean, we have hardly any. We have an arbitration case today, but we have hardly any arbitration cases anymore. Everything gets resolved. I mean, the grievance load is completely down. I mean, the working relationship. And this is since 2016. We've had two extensions on the contract since that because of that strike, you know. Lowell McAdams is gone. We have a new CEO that's just as good as the last one. And they want labor peace. And they want to work with us. And so it was that strike that, you know, that really, really turned things around, you know, for the better. You know, now we're all waiting for the other shoe to drop and something like that because it doesn't last forever, you know. But it's been going on for a long period of time. And we're pretty happy with it.
So this is all basically a reflection of the change in leadership in District 1, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. We could never have that. 2015 was it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
He got to see how he saw, caught that. What a smart guy.
That's why he was the vice president, secretary treasurer. That guy's name is Mark something.
Right. Mark, right, Irish name.
When we finished the contract that me and Navarro Sweeney? Actually.
Sweet.
No. I keep thinking green, but it ain't green.
Mark Green, no, he was a congressman.
Yeah. We went over to the hotel to shake hands.
Are we talking 2016?
I don't know what kind.
Okay. Yeah. A different one. A different one.
Yeah, that was earlier than that. Yeah.
Earlier.
It was earlier than that. But so we go over to the hotel to sign and TA and shake hands and all that. So he says to me, I guess he finally figured out that me and Navarro had done this because he got a call from Seidenberg, said, here's the contract, do it. And so he says to me, after I sign, he's walking over to shake my hand. He says, you stole my wallet. I said, look, Dan, I got your fucking shoes, too. He really hated us, and I hated him too.
It was mutual.
Oh, yeah. This guy was a bad guy. He really disliked people.
Yeah.
You know, there's some managers, hey, they're doing their job. I get that, but, you know.
Yeah, but somebody in a human resources position to hate people is
he was exactly the right place. People.
He hated unions, though. Yeah. I mean, he hated unions.
He came from wireless.
He came from wireless. He was one of the masterminds about keeping us out of there. Yeah. And then when he came out, he was trying to show that he changed his colors. Remember, he was trying to, you know, like, I'm a different guy. You don't really know me, you know. But
this is the same guy that told me old people are too expensive.
Right. You know, early on, I have to put this into the record since it's being recorded. He asked me about different leaders, and I neglected to tell, mention my brother, okay?
Yeah.
And we did everything together when I was in the local. We became chief stewards at the same time. He was chief steward of an installation repair garage in the Bronx, and I had construction. But later on, when we started, you know, moving up in the local, we did all kinds of organizing. I mean, all kinds of contracts together, and you know, I learned a lot from him. He learned a lot from me, but it was really good. So I needed to mention that.
Jimmy,
my younger brother.
How much younger?
2 years.
Mm-hmm. And Jimmy really was part of my contact with the Bronx because we both became chief stewards in AT&T at the Vestiture, and Jimmy kind of came down to Manhattan and worked with me and the other chiefs from Manhattan, and me and Jimmy got pretty close, and that was part of my connection to the Bronx, Jimmy. Mm.
Do you want to bring in any of the upstate locals as you're talking about this? How did you build unity there?
With the upstate locals? I think we have a council in the Verizon Telecom council that we have a coordinating council that we meet with, you know, on a regular basis. You know, they have monthly meetings and quarterly meetings with all the delegates in the councils. So they are very strong, you know, and I think when we started doing stuff with the wireless too, most of the same locals were the locals that we got in contact and worked with. But they, you know, they're smaller, but they work very well with us, you know.
The best answer for that is we didn't ignore them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, before that, they more or less had been ignored, and we didn't ignore them. And he doesn't to this day. You know, you can't just let people go off on their own and then expect them to do what you want.
So tell us more about your time as president of CWA.
Yeah.
What some of those experiences I'd like to hear about.
Well, when I first took over, I realized that the union was in pretty dire financial trouble. But I also realized that Larry, in his infinite intellect, had figured out a way to fix it. He just hadn't carried it over the finish line yet. Larry, in I forget what year it was, but I was on the board at the time, had created this SIF program. But we could only use it for certain things, and they were really limited. And we started putting a crack in that. Me and Seth started putting a crack in that when we decided that, okay, now we're going to use it for organizing.
Seth Rosen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought Larry was going to have a heart attack when we brought that up at an executive board meeting, but not only did it work, it passed the executive board, and then it passed the next convention. So we started using it for organizing, and then we started using it for something else, and something else, and something else. And it was part of it says you can't use it for normal union expenses. So, you know, we had to get somewhat creative, and we did get creative, and you know, to Larry's credit, that's his SIF program, and then we did the growth fund, and that's kind of what helped me and Sarah Steffens save the union from financial ruin, and we were on the way there. The other thing that, you know, I had to do things that I really hated. I really hated. The pension, for one. Mm-hmm. We had to figure out a way to convince our 11 unions that we needed to freeze the pension. And the board thought I was out of my mind. But we had to do it because we owed, at the point I walked in the door, we owed $60 million there. And that would have doubled or tripled by the end of my first term. We just couldn't do it. It was impossible. And we worked very hard to convince the 11 unions that we should do it. And to their credit, they understood and they agreed with us. And we froze the pension, and that saved us fortunes. Now, I got to tell you that because I'm now retired, and the pension plan that we started is paying off very well. Not as much as the old pension plan, but it's paying off very well. And when people retire, they'll get that pension plan and they'll be just as good as they were when we froze that pension. So there was that. We had a big problem. We had, quite honestly, there were places in this union that had too many people working there. They just had too many people working there. And I had to freeze hiring in every place. And then we did 3-for-1s and 2-for-1s. In other words, you had to lose 3 people to get one, or you had to lose 2 people to get one. And we had to do all that. And I hated doing all that stuff. You know, I always considered myself, and I still do, a true union guy. And all this shit was you know, like somebody shooting me in the back. But I had to do it. I couldn't let this union go by the wayside because we were stupid. And, you know, quite frankly, I think Sarah kind of paid for it.
Yeah.
And she shouldn't have, but she did.
Sarah Steffens.
Yeah. I think I probably should have paid for it, and I didn't, but, you know, some people were pretty pissed off and still are, I guess. I just hope that they listened because the union could still be in financial ruin, and if they don't watch what they're doing, it will be.
Let me interject. Jeff is very humble. When you talked about the Strategic Industry Fund and that being Larry's brilliant idea, it was during Larry and Jeff's joint.
That's absolutely true. I brought it up because Larry was the president.
I just wanted to.
But it's interesting when we did talk about it and the restrictions that we had to negotiate in order to get it through, we knew or felt confident at some point we would be able to break those barriers down and be able to use it for other things. But it was the idea of getting in place,
a foot in the door.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So for those who aren't in the room and may not know
by the
something,
way, and he knows this, mm-hmm. but those restrictions are still there. We just
right, you work around
they
them.
Mean something completely different right, now than right. they did when they right. were put in.
The financial problems, what were the sources of those financial problems when you came in?
People were spending too much money. The budgets were nuts. The pension plan was costing us so much money. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Like I said, I walked in the door in June. We had our first pension meeting in October. And we found out we owed $60 million then. And that was going to double and triple and quadruple shortly down the road.
Was the revenue side declining as well?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, so, that was a given that, you know, we were losing members, you know, not as many then probably as we are today, but, you know, we were losing members. We have an executive board that's too big, still too big. You know, I was able to do away with the print sector, and I didn't like doing that either, but it had to be. And there should be more of that. There are places in this union that don't need a whole administrative section, and I wish I could have done more. And if I had run again, I would have done more this time. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not easy. Even getting rid of the print sector that everybody thought got to go, wasn't, including the print sector, wasn't easy. But, you know.
Well, it helped that you had a bad guy running at the time.
Yeah.
That guy, well, I'll tell you, I've seen some bad people in this union, a lot of other unions too, but in this union, I've seen some bad people, not very many. Mm-hmm. That guy was bad people.
Just describe what the Strategic Industry Fund was, is, and why it was such a brilliant idea. What was the source of the funding?
It was removing money that locals were paying into the defense fund, or the members relief fund, and using it to do things to, as it said, Strategic Industry Fund. It was to improve industries. And when me and Seth said organizing, people thought we were out of our mind. But
we knew we had a lot of money in the Members Relief Fund, an abundance of money that we weren't going to use. Even if we went on strike for a long period of time,
Right. Okay,
we weren't going to hit it. So we wanted to make sure that we had a floor, that we protected that. But any additional money above that, okay, we could use strategically to really grow the union. That was the whole theory behind it. We'll get more people organizing, more people doing the work. And that's what we're doing. Most districts now have senior campaigns, campaign leads that were hired by these SIFs, these strategic energy funds, okay, to be able to bring people in, okay, to do that work, okay. And the locals were satisfied, okay, by taking the money out of the members' relief fund, that we still had money there protecting it, okay. So we didn't, so we had enough money just in case we ever went on strike, because that was the main reason to have the members' relief fund, that if we went on strike, there'd be money for people, you know, that were on strike. And the locals were happy by keeping the floor there, and they knew that we also had some kind of plan to grow the union, you know. So it was a great plan, Jeff and Larry and everybody else that got it done.
Yeah, Sarah did a study on all the strikes we had done up until, I don't know, 2016 or so, and how much they cost, and you know, how much out of the defense fund or the members relief fund they had cost. And it showed that if we kept it at, I think it's 400 million now, if we kept it there, we could never in a million years get to that number. You know, and if we did, it was a disaster, and
right,
the union would be out of business anyway. And that's kind of how the locals came to the realization that, hey, we got all this money. And Arthur Chaliota's famous quotes, who fought us tooth and nail, like they hit him with a bottle, but because he was the chair of the defense fund. But it's like dying, and we have enough money to bury the union in a velvet-lined casket. And that's true, we did. Because there was so much money in there, it was ridiculous. And Sarah's study proved it, and we got it. They got it passed, and then we got the growth fund passed, and that was also another way to, because by its very nature, it was there for one thing, and everybody chipped into that. The way the SIF is set up, every portion of the union has a silo that their members contribute to. The growth fund, it's everybody's money. In other words, we take money out of every silo to put in the growth fund. And that's for nothing else but to grow the union. Now, we got a little creative with what that means, but and we had to. But I tell you the truth, this union would have been bankrupt if we hadn't come up with that and done what we did to make sure it worked.
And we also, you know, we convincing the locals, even when we expanded to the growth fund and everything, even last year when we did some changes, and two years ago, or last two conventions ago, when we made some changes, we were able to convince the locals that if we didn't do this, okay, we were in danger. CWA was in danger. You may not like to hear this, okay? We're shrinking, that we may have to be the ones that go to another union and say, you know what, in order to survive, we got to merge with you. And by the way, we have all this money that we don't know what to do with because our members don't want to spend it, and we're going to give it to you. So is that what you want us to do, or do we want to try to grow the union? And
they bought into that, you know, and they, because that was our biggest fear, right? Yeah. Every time we did any of this, that they would fight us. The old Bob Lilgett people would just say, no, their money is there for strikes and strikes only, you know. So it was convincing the delegates. And the thing is, when we did it the first time, I think Larry had real concerns that we would never get this passed. Mm-hmm. And we were very careful about how much we were going to ask for. We all realized we could have asked for a lot more, you know.
Yeah, we could have.
We could have. So it was there. It was there for the taking then.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, like Larry was very cautious about it, and I don't blame him because it was something brand new and, you know, something that we didn't know.
Well, we were in our first term. We didn't know, you know, just exactly.
We knew it would work, but we didn't know if we could get the locals in the right place to do it. Right. And we knew we were going to have a line, and me and Jeff could probably write down a list. And we'd come up with the people be up at microphone saying, that money's for strikes. Mm-hmm. Never been on strike, you asshole. Sit down and shut up.
Well, we had a lot in District 1, too, that didn't talk the way you just talked. They would have been on that line. The Bob Lilsey crew.
And so one of the concessions we made was to give that Defenseman Oversight Committee oversight over the funds as well, so that, you know, they felt like
they just don't understand what the word oversight means.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, they have a different dictionary.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, it was, and, you know, like I said, it ripped my heart out to do the things I had to do, but I had to do them. And, you know, people to this day, I hear people running around now telling people how I screwed them on their budgets. That's not true. I did everything even-handed. As a matter of fact, and you can ask anybody that worked in Washington, the first place I would screw, if I had to screw anybody, it's right here.
District 1.
Yeah, because I didn't want them saying that.
Yeah.
You know, he's favoring District 1, because I wasn't. I was favoring CWA.
Mm-hmm. So you're president, late 2019, early 2020, COVID hits. How do you manage that process? What was that like?
Well, when it first hit, you know, obviously everybody was didn't believe what was happening and blah, 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 blah. And you had that schmuck in the White House. And, you know, I'll never forget this. And this is somebody who probably hates me to this day for it. But there was a District 3 conference coming up. And I stopped it. I said, no District 3 conference. And then they were like open arms. They were going to send snipers to Washington to get me. So no District 3 conference, that ain't happening. I think it was in New Orleans, but I can't swear to that. And so we canceled the District 3 conference. And then, you know, we had to start letting people work from home. And quite honestly, as everybody in this room, I'm sure, knows, Zoom, it saved us. But man, was it a pain in the ass. You know, it used to be somebody could walk in my office and say, hey, Chris, we want to do this. What do you think? I'd give them an answer and they'd be gone. 5 minutes. Instead, we'd have to have an hour and a half Zoom meeting with 15 people on it, all who had an opinion on whatever it was that I had to make a decision on that I wasn't going to listen to anyway. And, you know, it just took forever. Everything took forever. And it was annoying, but, you know, it was something that had to be. And thank God that we got through it pretty much unscathed, I'd say. And that's a credit to all our employees, because very few, I mean, I fired some people, but not that many, who weren't doing their job, but most of the people that work for us, 99%, did their job and did it even better than they did when they were coming to the office. They did an amazing job. The dues department, which I was most worried about, for the first time ever, and you know this better than I do, they were caught up. It was amazing. They were working from home and they were caught up. You know, we weren't 6 months behind. We were caught up. Everybody in Washington did a great job. Everybody in the districts. It was just out of this world. The one thing that I would say that I had to do that I hope no one ever has to do again is run a convention on Zoom. Man, well, you had to be in the room with me because, well, you know, and so do you. You don't know me that well, but I do not have a very good temper. And being in that room, I wanted to kill people. I mean, I was like out of my mind because, you know, I just give you one for instance. We argued about the word Cuba for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. 3 hours. I was ready to burn the building down by the end of that argument.
This is because people had unlimited access to chat and
people mic. Get behind a computer and say or do whatever they want. If they were there in person, there was one, I don't remember, but that
well, the only good thing about that for the people that were watching it is that we didn't have to stay tuned in. You know, we could walk away. Where Chris had to stay there the whole time. And the thing is, by the end of the day, you realize he was exhausted. I mean, it was just, it was so apparent on your face, you know, that God, will please, people will shut up. You know, it was tough. It was tough. But it got done. It got done.
It got done. Yeah.
A lot of work.
Which year with us? Which convention?
2019.
No, 2020. 2019, the very end of the year is when it started, and then 2020 is when March is when everything shut down.
Yeah, I think the convention was, it must have been 2021 because we just had
every 2 years.
Yeah.
It was 2021.
Right, we were thinking about having it, and then we had it.
And then there was a surge.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Worried about it.
Right.
Yeah, we were going to have it in person, and then we couldn't.
Yeah.
But it was. And like I said, not only for me, but for anybody who really, you know, really wanted to pay attention to the convention, it was tough to do. It was really tough to do. And for me, it was like, you know, trying to keep track of a convention without that is bad enough. Trying to keep a track of a convention with that, it was this close to impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, other unions think I'm completely out of my mind that I actually did that. That, you know, we had a Zoom convention with 2,000 delegates there. And they're probably right. That's not the only reason. It was bad. And hopefully never again, sorry. Because, you know, everything just took forever because people get behind a computer and say or do. I had visions of, now I know where that person would be sitting if we were having a convention, and if we were at a convention, they would have to walk past those guys from District 1. They would never make it. They'd never make it to the microphone. But they did because they all had a microphone.
So it's interesting, some of the day in and day out work of the union actually, from what you're saying, functioned better in many ways.
It did.
In a remote location, but other functions, meetings, you know, those types of things, even though you've got the technology in theory to do it, you lose something.
Well, you lose something and you gain something. All of a sudden, people who wouldn't say boo at a meeting in person, like even, you know, amongst people in Washington, you know, I had people talking, who the hell is that? Never heard of them. You know? And, you know, they would just say what they thought, and it's wonderful, but I wasn't interested. You know, I wanted to get things done, and everything just takes too long. But there were amazing places where it worked so well that I guess that's why they're still doing it.
Yeah. I got just a couple of wrap-up things. So I'd like both of you to think about this sort of last couple of questions here. One, what has been your biggest frustration in your time with the union? And also then, contrary to that, what do you see as your biggest accomplishment during your time within CWA? And then I've just got one last wrap-up question when we finish up here. So who wants to go first with either?
I'll go.
All right.
You know, I don't know if it's my biggest accomplishment, but it's one of them, I'd say. Helping lots of other people save this union from financial ruin, I think, is probably the biggest accomplishment for anybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing is the new slant on organizing that we've gotten, mm-hmm. where we're doing a lot of tech, and we're doing, for instance, the Microsoft deal. Everybody said, nah, never going to happen. And I said, okay, maybe you're right. The Times reporter just asked me what I thought of Brad Smith, the CEO of Microsoft. And, I said at first I thought he was full of shit. And then I started to believe. And I think then he started to believe. He probably thought I was full of shit, too. And we both started to believe each other and figured out that both of us were telling the truth. And then when we went to organize ZeniMax, and they were even more neutral than we could have asked for. It was amazing. They put out a statement to the employees saying, if you have questions about the union organizing, now, you know, in a regular organizing, what the end of that would be, right? If you have questions about the union organizing, call the union. I was like completely aghast when I saw that. And they really meant it. They wouldn't answer anything. They just, we're neutral. And they got their managers, and they told them, because we had spies, of course. They told their managers, you violated, you're fired. Don't even come back to work, you're fired.
Which group was this now?
Microsoft.
Microsoft.
ZeniMax.
Okay, yeah. But owned by Microsoft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I had that asshole that was the CEO of, what's the name of the company that we first started, Activision?
Mm-hmm.
What's his name? I don't remember his name, but he was a real son of a bitch. Brad Smith told me he was going to control him. I said, okay, we'll see. And he did. He absolutely did. And to this day, they've done the right thing. And I think that eventually that will go down as a big accomplishment for CWA. I don't know that it has paid off that much yet, but it will. Mm-hmm. Microsoft has 100,000 employees. And they will be completely neutral.
Not to mention the impact it has on other tech companies as well.
That was a big part of the reason that I went to see the FTC commissioner, because that's what I was selling here.
Right.
You know, and she started arguing with me, telling, well, we've seen these agreements before, and as soon as the merger takes place, that's the end of the agreement. I said, you don't understand something. This agreement, we couldn't show her the agreement because it was confidential. Mm-hmm. This agreement is such that if they do what you're saying, that they always do, that companies always do, and you're right, they do. I said, if they do that, I become the CEO of Microsoft. That thing has teeth. And she didn't believe, I don't know if she believed me or not. She's just dead set against mergers. And my argument was that, look, Microsoft, one of the biggest companies on earth, we get a foolproof agreement with them. A union gets a foolproof agreement with them to be neutral. And just imagine the effect it'll have on every other company who ever wants to merge. And she didn't buy any of that. So I think those two things are big part of what I hope I accomplished.
Yeah. Dennis?
So, in thinking about this, I also thought about two other strikes that we had here in District 1 in the last few years. And I think my accomplishment with the strikes that we've had in District 1, you know, anytime you bring members out on strike, you worry about getting them back in again. And you you really worry about that. I remember in the 2016 strike, it started worrying me that we weren't going to settle this, and there were a lot of families out there, because my son actually worked for him, and that's why he even took it home, and his son also worked there. But I mean, he wasn't getting the paychecks, and you know, I was able to help him out and stuff like that. But I said, how many other families don't have their fathers or somebody helping them out? And that weighs on you. But knowing that we were prepared and we did everything we possibly could, and the two other strikes I mentioned, IUE had a strike in 2018 here, where we helped them, and it's the triangle comes into effect. Our political strength in this district is what helps us get those contracts. And with the IUE, we couldn't get there. I went to Governor Cuomo. Governor Cuomo got me in a meeting with the CEO, where we were meeting, and as we're meeting with the CEO gets a phone call, and it's the governor, okay? He's talking to the governor, and the CEO turns around to me, and he says, he wants to talk to you. And he said, he's going to give you what you want. That's what the governor, Cuomo's telling me, you know? So it's that kind of, you know, the power that we have developed, you know, in the district. Bob did a fantastic job. Our political department now, with Halen and the people that work for us, we have a young group here that I tell Bob I'll even miss him. You know, he's because they're so good at what they do, and it's to me, it makes me younger just watching them work, because they're just fantastic. But they do the work to get us the contracts. There's all the people behind the scenes, you know. Catholic Health, in 2020, we went on strike.
That was up in Buffalo.
That whole department went up there, and our organizers all went up there for weeks on end. Halen has young children. She was flying back and forth like every 2 days just to be with the kids for a while, then flying back up there again. But they kept the mobilization strategy going. They got me meetings with the governor. They got meetings with the attorney general. And we had, when the governor didn't know which way she was going to turn, okay, the attorney general showed up at our picket line, and all of a sudden Governor Hochul was saying, I'm with you too, you know what I mean? And how can I help? But it was because of that political strength that we got it. And our members know that, our locals know that, and it's I think that's what I feel my biggest accomplishment, you know, like from the SNET days of having that strike, having the strikes with CWA, against Verizon and Catholic Health and IUE, to be there and having us work as a unit, that I feel so proud to be part of CWA, you know. So that's my story.
The IUE strike was where and when?
It was in 2000. I can't think of the company right. Do you remember the name of that company?
Starts with an M.
Momentum.
Look at that. What a team.
Yeah. Yeah, we put our heads together.
Exactly.
You can't come up with Mark's last name.
Yes, we have one. Yeah. I'm glad you brought
in the politics, because I think that was another thing that we haven't talked much about, but that both of you in District 1 understood
the political.
And some of the, I mean, talk about the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. That relationship goes back a long time.
So when she first ran for the city council.
And we were having arguments with Verizon. We were trying to get the contract with Verizon Wireless and organize the Brooklyn stores. She was with me, and we're outside the store. She says, we're going in. I said, we're going in. She went in and says, who's the manager here? You know? And she demanded him, you know? And to see her now, what she did with Trump and everything like that, it reminds me of the days that she went into those stores. And I said, she doesn't put up with any crap. You know what I mean? Not at all. She's a great friend to have. She's a really great friend to have.
That same idea goes with Schumer.
Yeah.
We supported him when he first ran for the city council in New York. Hakeem Jeffries, we supported him when he first ran. You know, we have hooks everywhere.
And in 2016, Tom Perez.
Yeah. Oh, that.
The White House.
We didn't get him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in Jersey, you know, under Governor Christie, you know, our pension was going in the toilet, okay? It was just being wiped out, okay? Governor Murphy has worked with me from day one, okay, saying, I'm going to save your pension. He never once broke his promise to me at all on that. He's fully funded it 3 times in a row, okay? And, you know, it's been, it's in better shape now than it's been in 30 years, okay? So that's the power of the politics. And, you know, it's unfortunate because our locals don't even understand that sometimes. Yeah. You know, they say, well, he's the boss, he's doing this. They say, listen, he's the boss, he saved your pension. Christie, we weren't going to have a pension under Christie. We have a pension now, you know. But it's the politics there that saved that, you know, and it's us working that angle, you know. And it's this OCWA triangle that, you know, that works.
Sometimes you can't tell the locals how something occurred. Like, he's gone now. Well, he's not gone, but Marty Walsh, the Secretary of Labor. I did shit with him that no one would believe, but I can't talk about it. But no one would believe it. And I didn't support the guy when he went in there. Mm-hmm. Me and him became fast friends, and Cuomo. Everybody hates Cuomo now. Cuomo and me and him were like this. And did anything we ever asked. Anything we ever asked. I went to him about offshore wind when the IUE decided they wanted to get into the offshore wind business. Had dinner with him on Tuesday. Sunday morning, he's calling me up saying, okay, I got this apprenticeship program set up for you, and we're going to run a school. We're going to cover the whole cost of it. You guys don't have to worry about it, but we're going to make sure that, I mean, he got bounced out of office. Yeah. So we'd be doing the offshore wind right now. Yeah. Well, we are anyway, but what we're going to be when.
This is the manufacturing of the huge
blades
for the turbines. Yeah.
The nacelles.
Yeah.
What?
The nacelles. They're called nacelles. Nacelle.
You've become expert in many things.
Yeah.
He was.
Sometimes you have to.
Cuomo wanted me. He wanted to put me on the. On the board of the New York Power Authority, you know. So I said, yeah, I'll do it, you know. So.
Well, that's a long history. Morty was very close with his father.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's when I first met him.
Is that right?
Morty and his father were tight. I met him when he was 19 years old.
Wow. Yeah, and Nalini, who used to be our administrative secretary here, she remembers him coming here. He was in one of the offices when, you know, he was his campaign manager, you know.
Wow. So the last question to wrap this up. What advice would you offer for future CWA leaders? What piece would you like them to walk away from this with? And I had Chris go first last time. So
I just think stay involved with the locals, stay involved with the members, and make sure that, you know, they come first. You know, that's the most important thing. The locals come first. I have a standard order right now that, you know, before anything goes out to the membership, that the local presidents have to know about that first. They get the first wind of it. You know, you have to continue with that and make sure that they're involved. Keep everybody involved. Work the triangle, and we'll be successful.
Yeah. Chris?
Above all, listen to the members. They're the smartest people in this union. And come up with your own ideas, but listen to the members, because if the members don't like whatever, and I've come up with a lot of harebrained schemes, but if the members don't like whatever it is you're coming up with, listen to the members. If they do like it, go full speed ahead. This union and every other union, they don't, but they should, has to be run by the members.
This has been great.
Yeah,
I can't thank you guys enough for spending this much time with us. This is terrific.
We appreciate you doing it. You know?
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where you don't want to lose that. You know, this history of the union. Like we said, I mean, we would have loved the opportunity to sit down with a Morty Barr.
Yeah.
And, you know, pick his brain about
it. Morty would have been great at this.
Oh, can you imagine?
Oh, my God.
I mean, it would have gone on for days.
Days is right.
He was such a great storyteller.
Right. You know? I had conversations with Morty that lasted this long.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right.
And I never said a word.
You know, yesterday I called Pat Telesco up, you know.
I've been thinking about her when you talk about it.
And
she's not retired yet.
No, she takes care of AT&T mobility for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She coordinates the Orange contract and everything. But she said that she always wished that we kept a diary of what was going on, you know, from year to year to year, because there's just so many things that, you know, we've done as a district, you know, and and they, we just forget about
them. Well, so and you gloss over them too. I mean, you know, you think about bringing the operators in. What a difference that made in their lives.
Yeah.
You know what? And obviously those jobs are for the most part gone now. But, yeah. What would their exit have been like?
Right.
Had they not been represented by CWA rather than, you know, a company union, basically.
Yeah.
It was a company union.
Yeah, right. And I mean, just all those little moments that now sort of, you know, just get forgotten about almost, that made a difference in the lives of thousands of people.
The day that we had the vote for the operators, we were in a Prince George Hotel on 23rd. It's not there anymore.
I was in a bar.
Well, anyway, as we get there in the morning, I hold the door open for some people coming in, and it's May Kleisch, who was the president of the operators local, plus John, whatever his name was, who was the president of TIU. And they told me, you know, who he was. Or he told me who he was, I think. And I said, yeah, well, get used to this, because you'll be doing this for a living when this vote counts over. Hold the doors open.
It's hard to strike. I mean, and most of the time our locals want to do it. I mean, in 2016 with Verizon, they broke our chops every single day. We want to go out, the bargaining committee, the locals, why aren't we on strike? Why aren't we on strike? We said, we're not ready. And it's not the right time. The company wants us to go out. And we're not ready, you know. And we had to wait for months on end, you know, to get everybody ready, to make sure that they were ready, you know. And I don't think people are willing to do all that work beforehand, you know what I mean? And we have good people that did it. I mean, Bob, I can't tell you the amount of work that he puts in when you know, he always dreads when the contract time's up, because he knows what he has to do to prepare. And he gets the people to do it. And he developed, before Bob left, isn't that a great thing that we should always imagine? Develop good people to follow you, okay? Because he did an unbelievable job of developing not one but several, you know, and we have such a team here. It's unbelievable, and it's so important, because all that work, okay, if we didn't have Bob doing that work, we wouldn't have been successful. And I'll be honest with you, Bob won those strikes for us, you know, by the mobilization work and the political work. Okay, if we didn't have Bob, we didn't, you know, it wasn't me at the table, him getting anybody else or him at the table. That's not winning it. You know that, right? It's what happens behind the scenes, you know, that does it, you know?
Right. As Jeff said before, the people that work for you, let them do what it is they're good at and stay out of their way, but back them up if you have to.
Yeah.
And that here works, you know, admittedly, I guess I'm prejudiced, but in this union, and Jeff may get pissed off at me about this, but this district is head and shoulders above any other district. There's nothing that can compare with it.
He would get pissed off at that, I would think.
No, I would acknowledge that.
Okay.
No, you won't get an argument from me.
I can tell
this
you
this is
that.
The benchmark, what we all strive to be, is what you guys have got here and created here.
You know, District 4 is close behind, you know. I can trust, or he can trust Linda better than most people I've ever seen. And, you know, I wish the rest of them were like that. They're not. And it's not necessarily the leader's fault. It's that they haven't done the work to get the locals where they got to get them, or there's new officers who are just not there. And do me a favor, don't ever do this again, because you got me thinking that I should have never retired.
Well, I call them all the time. I say, you having a good time? He said, no, I'm not having a good time.
Are we off the record now?
We can be.
Yeah. Let's go off the record. Yeah.